STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
All right, friends. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Does my voice sound a little hoarse? It does to me. I've been talking. Oh, man, I've been on the road a lot since we last talked, and then carrying on here at the office about some current events that I'll be talking about shortly. So much to discuss with you. Did I mention Stand to Reason is the name of the show? If I didn't, I've done it now, and you know where you're at. Glad to have you on board. Looking forward to 3 hours of conversation with you about the critical issues of life, ethics, values, and religion. Got a lot to say, and I'm looking forward to your calls. And many people queued up right now. I want to start out, though, by talking to my buddy Frank Turek over at Cross Examined Instructor Academy. Frank, hey, how you doing?
Greg, I'm doing wonderful, and I just last week was in Dallas at Watermark Church,
I know...
If you have people listening live right now, they can see you there.
That's right.
This Saturday, I saw you in the bulletin. We went to the church down there, and I was excited to see you going. That is a great church down there.
Thank you.
You're going to enjoy that.
Yeah, you and I were there last year or maybe a year and a half ago,
right.
And Ravi Zacharias was there, also Bill Craig, John Stone Street, and we had a fabulous time with that massive audience in that great church. I'm looking forward to that this weekend, doing Tactics on Saturday and then Sunday doing the morning services and then Sunday night doing a dialogue with Todd, the pastor, from the stage. So I'm sure that you got a great reception last weekend.
Well, I was just actually there. I was down there with my son, who's about to go off to guitar for a year, and I was speaking at UT Dallas and UT Arlington. I just happened to go to the church just to see Todd,
and he
did a great job in his service. But I had spoken there on a Saturday before, and they'll bring out quite a crowd, and so it's going to be I encourage all the people listening right now to go to that. And you're going to be there Sunday, too?
I'll be there for the Sunday services, so I'll get the whole crowd there in the regular
excellent services.
I'll be talking about the two miracles. It's the miracle of the cross, the miracle of the resurrection, appropriate for the beginning of Passion Week. So it's just going to be great here. But, I mean, the great turnout that we saw there last year when all of us came out is just in what we've experienced over the last few years in this resurgence of interest in thoughtful Christianity and standing up to reason to take the message to the critics in a gracious way is a huge part of your vision for Cross Examined Instructors Academy. We'll be doing that together once again. I don't know if this is our sixth year together, whatever, but in August. Why don't you tell us about that, Frank?
Yeah, Greg, it's going to be our seventh, believe it or not. Seventh annual Cross Examined Instructors Academy, CIA for short. Mm-hmm. And what we do there is we have 3 full days of instruction, and the participants present back to us. And when I thought about doing this over 7 years ago now, the first person I thought of was you, because you're so good at interacting with people on these issues and teaching them how to tactfully, using tactics, control a conversation. And that's what we need to do. We need to be able to ask the right questions and have the right gracious responses, because, as you put it, you don't want this to be D-Day. You want it to be
diplomacy.
An interaction where you can move the ball forward with somebody and ultimately, if at all possible, bring them closer to Christ. And so there's nobody better than you at that. And, of course, we've got Brett Kunkel coming, J. Warner Wallace. It's like all of Stand to Reason is coming to help us do this at Cross Examined, as you guys do every year. And we'll also have Ted Wright. We'll have Richard Howe. So we're going to have a great team again to teach people how to present and how to answer questions.
Right.
It's August 14 to 16, 3 full days. So anybody who can hear this, if you come to this event, it's going to be relatively small. When we say relatively small, we're talking 50 max.
Right.
And you're going to be able to interact and get instruction from Greg Kokel, from Jay Warner Wallace, from myself, from others. So I highly encourage people to sign up.
Yeah, it's such a to me, I always look forward to it, not only because I like hanging out with you, Frank, and the boys, but it isn't just us getting together. It's everybody's hanging out together because
right.
This isn't a big stage event. You're not half a mile away with big speakers. It's a classroom where we're all together working together, and the talks are fluid. I mean, I get to interrupt you in the middle of your talk
right.
if I have something to add, and people can ask questions. And then, of course, we have meals together. We have evening events together. We have, as you pointed out, the students get a chance to take the material that you've structured and your slide presentation, your notes, and take a chunk of it and actually practice doing a presentation in a safe environment where they can get feedback on their technique so that they can, and this is what's so unique about Cross-Examine Instructor Academy, we are training instructors, people who've got the desire to do this, have a little, they've gotten their feet wet a little bit, but need some more direction and more mentoring, I guess, to put it more precisely, Frank. They'll have a chance to mix it up in a personal way with all of the faculty. You mentioned Brett and Jay Warner and Richard Howe, and a whole, you know, there's always a huge, a wonderful cadre of people. You know, I ran into a graduate, was it 2 weeks ago at Columbus, Ohio? And I recognized him. And I said, what
that
do I recognize?
Eric Chabot, probably.
Yeah. He said from Cross-Examine Instructor Academy about mm-hmm. 3 or 4 years ago. And I had actually been his trainer. So when he gave his presentation, I was the one who kind of juried and gave feedback. And he's in play. You know, he's working at his local church. He's speaking. He's working with groups. And he benefited tremendously from the education and training he got from CIA.
Oh, exactly. In fact, Greg, you do a very thorough job on critiquing these guys, so they really walk away with something that can improve their presentation skills. We just had a CIA graduate debate at the University of Michigan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so these people aren't just this isn't just an academic exercise where they come and they learn some new apologetics. That's not what they're coming for.
Right.
They're coming to actually employ apologetics in wherever they're planted, bloom wherever they're planted. So some of them are teaching this, obviously, in their churches. Others are going into high schools. They're doing it in small groups. This one, Scott Simonton was his name. He just debated a guy out in University of Michigan just a couple of weeks ago, an atheist.
Wow.
So this is being used. We have several CIA graduates come back through. We've had some
That's
people
right.
come two or three times.
Uh-huh.
The folks down in Dallas where I just was, Alan Hainlein and Bo Bishop and others, they've been a couple of times, if not more, and they're running Reasonable Faith for William Lane Craig down there
right.
in Dallas, and they just had me down there at a couple of universities. So CIA graduates are actually engaged in apologetics. It's not just an academic, intellectual edification for themselves. They're actually using it.
You know, I love the phrase you use. Of course, I've used it many times myself, bloom where you're planted,
mm-hmm.
because what it does is it emphasizes for people who are thinking about doing this that we don't have this straitjacketed kind of way of taking this and putting it into play. You got to do this. People take it, and they can, just as you pointed out, Frank, they can use it at whatever level they're capable of using it, wherever they are planted. And chances are, of course, when they start using it where they're at, then they can move into other circumstances as they get better. This is going to be like a boot camp of sorts, but you don't end with boot camp. Boot camp is for the purpose of training people to go forward and to begin putting this in play in whatever circumstances they're in. Can you tell us a little bit, Frank, about the qualifications for CIA coming up August 14th through 16th in Charlotte, where you hold this event at SES?
Yes, it's going to be – all the details are on our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org, and I think it'll be linked to at Standard Reason as well.
Mm-hmm.
You can go up there and you'll see right on the top menu, CIA, what is CIA, what are the qualifications and all that. The qualifications to come to CIA, we don't want somebody who doesn't know anything about apologetics.
Right.
It's we need people that have at least some basis in it.
Yeah.
They may have been studying it for a while. Maybe they're using it a little bit, or they'd like to start using it. We have all different age groups come to this. We have high school all the way to retired people coming to this. But we want people
men
to have some
women.
Basis in it. They have to, of course, have read I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. They have to have read Tactics. And when I say that, I don't just mean read and casually read. They've got to get into it, outline it, make some of the material their own, because they are going to present back to us. And there are several other works that we highly recommend, of course, Cold Case Christianity by J. Warner Wallace, and several others that are listed on the website. So if they go to the website, they can see the application process. We don't it's not free. There is a charge for this, quite obviously, because you're with us for 3 days, and we feed you all 3 days and all that. We don't just take anybody. You have to apply. So if they go there, they can get all the details, crossexamined.org.
Now, somebody was talking with me a couple of days ago, I think in Topeka, Kansas, where I was at, or maybe it was in Houston last – no, it was in Houston just over the weekend. And she's looked at the stuff, and she really wants to go. She does not have a bachelor's degree, but she is doing some really fabulous things. And she was – she was under the impression, and I don't know if this is a requirement or not. I hadn't heard this before, that you had to have a bachelor's degree. Is that the case, or do you take
No, it's not, because sometimes we take high school kids.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, you mentioned
that. Or kids that are going into college. You don't need to have a bachelor's degree to go to it.
Okay.
You just need to have some background. And when I say background, what I mean is you just didn't read more than a carpenter and show up and go, okay, I'm ready to go.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, not a newbie.
You've got to be more of a student than that.
Yeah, well, this gal is just, she is on fire, and she is a real student of this stuff, but she was thinking, but I didn't get my bachelor. I said, I don't think this is a problem, and you seem to be really qualified. She's going to be on board, and I always like it when graduates come back and they go for a second shot, you know, to sharpen their skills and to be more effective. I'm really, really looking forward to our time there, Frank. Is it? Can you give us just a little picture of the kinds of classes or information that will be conveyed by you and Brad and myself, just to get people up to speed?
Sure. In previous years, the first 5 or so years, we had everyone in one room all the time. And the last year, we started breakout sessions, and we're going to do that again this year. So people that want to come back can, of course, come back and take different breakout sessions. And I think the breakout sessions, I think you might agree, Greg, that you could do a little bit more interaction with people. And since that's really your specialty, I think that works very well. So obviously, they're going to get aspects of I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, but we're not going to go through the whole argument. We expect them to have seen that and gone through it themselves before.
Right.
The same thing is true with Tactics, although you will be talking about Tactics. J. Warner Wallace is going to talk about Cold Case Christianity, quite obviously, and he'll talk about a few other things. We may spend a little bit of time on social issues like same-sex marriage, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Brett Kunkel will probably talk about the moral law and how he takes kids to Berkeley and how that ministry has changed what he does and has changed the kids that he takes. We'll have Ted Wright talking a little bit about archaeology. Richard Howe gets into philosophy and how you can use it to improve your theology and how you can interact with some of the claims of the new atheists. So there's a waterfront of issues that we cover. And there's a lot of Q&A, and as you said just a few minutes ago, Greg, which is really quite interesting. You rarely go to a presentation where other instructors interrupt one another and say, "Hey, you just made me think of something else."
No, it's really a great. I love that aspect of it because it makes it a little bit more informal feeling. Everybody's kind of part of the group, and you and I can pitch in on each other's talks. And I'm glad that there's going to be an opportunity for just discussing a little bit about same-sex marriage. You know about Brendan Eich, the Mozilla, and I mean, I'll be talking about that soon. Somebody called into the show and said, "You know, I think you guys talk about same-sex marriage, or rather about homosexuality, too much." And my thinking is, I'd just be glad to move on to other things. They keep pushing it on us, you know, and so we're in a defensive posture. As you know, because you suffered your own setbacks, like similar to what Brendan has done at Mozilla, and this was a couple years ago. So the reason it's important is because it's out in play, and followers of Christ, ambassadors for Christ, CIA instructors who are blooming where they're planted, are going to have some capability of maneuvering a little bit in that conversation, because it just can't be avoided. These people are going to push it on you. So I'm glad that you're focusing in on that. What about transportation and lodging? This is going to be at Charlotte.
It's all going to be in Charlotte at the Southern Evangelical Seminary. It's a beautiful location. And lodging is all on the website as well. We have a couple of hotels relatively close that we recommend. And Charlotte Airport's easy to get in and out of. You're only half an hour from the airport when you arrive, or when you arrive, you're only half hour really from the seminary. The airport's only half hour from the seminary where we hold it. So everything works quite well. It's a great building. We got breakout rooms. We all eat together most of the meals. So you're not only, if you're listening right now, you're not only going to get to listen to Greg Kokel and interact with Greg Kokel, you're going to be able to sit down and have dinner with Greg Kokel and
and Frank Turek and Brett
and
Kunkel.
And Jay Warner-Wallace and Richard Howe and Ted Wright and Brett Kunkel. Who knows? Who knows who else will show up?
Okay, there'll be, and sometimes we have surprise guests town. So there's tuition involved, of course. That's on the website at CrossExamined with a D, CrossExamined.org. There is transportation and lodging they have to take care of, but that's also, you have details for that, that can all be worked out. Work out the details. But this is going to be 3 days of a fabulous training experience, August 14th through 16th. It's Charlotte, North Carolina. And, Frank, you got a great vision here for equipping people, and you've been doing a great job in the last 6 years. Now, this is our seventh, or this is our eighth.
This is our seventh.
Our seventh.
Seventh annual.
And I really am thrilled to partner with you and be in the harness with you with this really fun but productive enterprise called Cross Examined Instructor Academy. Thanks so much for what you're doing, and I look forward to hanging out with you.
Well, Greg, thanks for all you're doing and getting the word out. And, of course, we wouldn't be doing it without you. As I say, you're the first person we thought of when we said, well, we got to do this. who can help us? Well, of course, Greg can.
I will.
And that was, I think, maybe 1 year prior to Tactics came out, because I remember we didn't even have the book. We just PDFs.
That's right. That's right.
And now the book is out.
Sure.
The book's doing well.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to get Tactics before they come. They need to read it. They need to outline it. They need to be able to use it, because that's what we're doing here. This isn't just academics. This is real-world interaction on how to show people why Christianity is true in an artful and attractive way.
Well, I closed the book Tactics with a chapter called More Sweat, Less Blood, kind of named after the Marine Corps kind of training dictum, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. And we're in a battle here, and this is obvious. And you and I and Brett and Jay Warner and the rest of them, Richard, we want to be there as cadre to help our brothers in arms and sisters in arms to be prepared for these things. And I just realized, by the way, I don't have to wait until CIA to see you. We're going to the Philippines together.
I know. In fact, Greg, that's why we moved it 1 week out. CIA this year is 1 week later. It's August 14 to 16. Because you, myself, William Lane Craig, and Abdu Murray are going to be in Manila.
And our wives. So this is going. We're going to be working hard there for a weekend, but we'll have a couple days to spend together.
Let me mention one other thing before we go.
Sure.
Another thing that I think people can start getting ready for CIA right now is, I'm sure they have the STR app. If not, they need to have it. They need to be listening to these podcasts every week.
Yeah,
they need to get the Reasonable Faith app as well and start listening to William Lane Craig.
Uh-huh.
We have an app, the Cross-Examined app, with a quick answer section on there that can get them ready as well.
Yeah.
Of course, Jay Warner Wallace, he's out there as well. They need to avail themselves, Ravi Zacharias, they need to avail themselves of these apps or these podcasts right now if they want to come to CIA, because the kind of stuff you talk about every week, Craig, myself, Jay Warner Wallace, Ravi Zacharias, this is the kind of stuff that we're going to be trying to train you on, so you can make it part of just the way you are. Naturally, you can talk to people right. about these issues. So start preparing right now.
Yeah. So the more you're up to speed on the information, you got, what, 4 months or something, May, June,
yep.
July, August, April, May, June, July. You got 4 months plus. The more you're up to speed, the more beneficial the time that you spend there, 14 through 16 August with the CIA Academy, I guess that is cross-examine instruct. That is CIA. So that's kind of like the PIN number. You know, it's a redundancy there.
That's right.
Okay, it's cross-examined with a D.org. All the information, details on the qualifications, what you have to do, preparing, the costs, transportation, lodging, any other questions. It's all right there. Frank Turek, me. Brett Kunkel, J. Warner Wallace, and Richard Howe. I mean, we got a great faculty going. We hope to see you there. It's going to be a great time with a small group of people learning to be soldiers for Christ. Looking forward to it, Frank.
Thanks, brother. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Take care, buddy.
God bless.
God bless you. And one more time, crossexamined.org for all the skinny on that. Hope to see you there. Let's go to break, and then I'll come back with more on Stand to Reason.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
All right, here we are. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reasons, the show, and here to give you a piece of my mind. With you pretty much every week for 3 hours. Last weekend, I was, last week on Tuesday, a week ago today, I was in Topeka, Kansas. That night at Washburn University, I have a tall tale to tell about that, but I'm going to have to save that and also my expansive remarks on what has happened at Mozilla. And I have some words also regarding World Vision, kind of on the same topic, but conciliatory remarks for their reversal 2 weeks ago after I gave them such a hard time on the air. Not that they cared what I had to say, but I was glad to see that they changed their mind on a general posture regarding same-sex marriage. We will come back to all of those things next hour. I want to jump right in. I got a full line of callers, and when you guys are so nice to call in so quickly and get in the queue, I can't resist going to you and talking with you. I don't want you to wait too long, though I got a lot of other things to say. Let's start with Chris in Boise, Idaho. Chris, hey.
Hi, Greg. This is Chris. Hey, you know,
yes,
I've heard there's a lot of great bass fishing out here.
In Boise?
Yeah, well, you know, in the surrounding area. So.
Well, you know, I didn't know that. Would it be smallmouth or largemouth, or do you know the difference?
You know, I'm not too sure, but I'm actually pretty sure it's bigmouth, largemouth.
Yeah, you know, I am taking my trip to do my annual 2-week spring fishing trip in Wisconsin in May.
Yeah.
And it's 4 weeks out, and my buddy in Wisconsin just told me that the ice on the lakes where I'm going right now are 36 to 48 inches thick.
Unbelievable.
I mean, that's going to take a lot of warm rain to melt down. So I'm kind of hoping I'm not having to hack a hole in the ice when I go up there in early May. But that's another issue. Go ahead.
I told my daughter I was going to take her bass fishing this year. We're done with trout.
Oh, okay. Well, there's good trout fishing up there. Lake Ponderay, that's in your neck of the woods, isn't it?
That doesn't sound familiar.
Well, it's a huge lake up somewhere up there. That's where the world record rainbow used to be from. I don't know. But in any event, it looks like Pend Aurelles is the way they spell it, but I think they call it Ponderay.
Oh, okay.
In any event, from the ridiculous to the sublime, your your question.
You know, I think it was a week or two ago, somebody came up with a question about babies, and you responded with the age of accountability, which seemed to be the theology that I was raised on. I'm an adult convert, but I'm just now getting, you know, more familiar with Reformed theology.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't quite see how Reformed theology would fit with the age of accountability in that everyone's elected anyway. So what does age of accountability have to do with it?
Well, it seems like if there is an age of accountability, which means that that there is a time before which someone is not personally accountable for sin because they don't have the developmental apparatus that allows them to be capable of making a meaningful moral choice, then it seems that God is not justified in punishing them for crimes they did not commit.
But aren't we all under the sin of Adam?
Well, we are, and that is a little bit of a difficulty in my view. But a couple of thoughts, and I did mention this a couple of weeks ago when this came up. There is a verse that makes reference to what we call the age of accountability, and that is in Isaiah 7. And right around the virgin shall give birth passage, mm-hmm. I'm just flipping to it quickly, and it talks
and before the child can choose or deny evil and choose good.
Yes, right, and so it identifies that there is such a time when you look in the book of Revelation. These are the pieces of my puzzle, though the text doesn't directly and decisively address the question. The way I address the way I kind of put the pieces together is that reference there. Then I get to go to the book of Revelation. There seems to be the judgment, the details of the judgment, the book of Revelation, mm-hmm. seem to be based on deeds that were done, and these are deeds written in the book. Mm-hmm. And so if a person has not the ability to choose right or wrong before a certain age, then those deeds are not in the book. It doesn't mm-hmm. seem that the deed that they're being judged for is the sin of Adam. It is the deed that they're being judged for is the deeds that they actually do, possibly as a result of being fallen in Adam. So, there's two ways to approach this. One could say that the sin of Adam does not, and this isn't my view. I know this is another way of addressing it. The sin of Adam is real for humankind, but it is not applied to one's account until he acts it out and lives it out. Okay, and then the deeds are recorded, and so prior to that, before the age of accountability, then there is no sin, and the innocent one, dying through abortion or as a babe or whatever, is then just ushered right into God's presence.
Can I cut in real quick and play the
devil's advocate?
I hate to say it, but yeah.
It's all right. That's what it's called. You know where the term came from? Term came from when the canonization process in Roman Catholicism, somebody's campaigning for the canonization of this person they think will be a saint. Well, you've got to have somebody on the other side. So you've got kind of peer review and keep people honest, and they called that person the devil's advocate.
All right. Excellent.
Okay.
I can only imagine that somebody would, because I thought of it instantly when I heard this. And again, I'm newer to Calvinism, but isn't it almost? Gosh, I even hate to say this; it sounds terrible. Isn't it almost? Well, okay, if the kids that are aborted are ushered right into heaven, like you said earlier, isn't it almost I don't want to say better, but what's so bad?
I understand your line of thinking. If we kill the babies while they're on this theology, then we are ushering all these babies into heaven.
Right.
But see, here now you've got a situation where you are justifying the means by the end, and you're saying what looks like an immoral means become morally acceptable because the end is a noble end. And in moral decision making, the means and ends are both part of the moral equation. So even if you have a moral end, getting someone into heaven, you can have an immoral means to do that. Taking their life is an immoral means, so the act is immoral. So with regards to the individual decision making, you are not free. The moral decision-making here, you are not free to do an immoral thing to accomplish what you think is a moral end, all right? Secondly, there is no guarantee that my line of thinking is accurate on this issue. Remember, I'm doing the best I can to put together the pieces, mm-hmm. but my thinking may be flawed. Since the Bible does not address it, we do the best we can, but it's hard to be dogmatic when the Scripture isn't clear. And so, therefore, it may not be the case that when you abort a child, that child goes to heaven.
Right. So when does election come into play here? Because I thought it was every kid or every person was either elected or not elected.
That's
period.
True. That's true.
So if a kid is born or aborted, whether or not they've reached the age of accountability, wouldn't they have already been elected or non-elected?
Well, yeah, that's in the mind of God and in the counsel of God and according to the good pleasure of God. So once you get into who's elected and who's not elected and all that other stuff, now you're kind of going behind the curtain of God's sovereignty and things get really screwy there because it's hard to see everything that's going on. Okay. What we do know, following my theological convictions, is that people are lost in sin. Mm-hmm. And they sin because they're sinners. And when they sin, in virtue of being sinners, they are culpable. And they are in rebellion against God, and they suppress the truth and unrighteousness, and they are held captive by Satan to do his will, and all of these mm-hmm. nasty things that hold him enslaved, and the only one that can rescue him is God. And mm-hmm. some people God does rescue, and some God decides to allow to continue in their rebellion against him, and then he judges them appropriately. So every act of God, whatever it is that God does, not just election, even answering your prayer, the prayer you prayed yesterday that God answered today, God mm-hmm. didn't decide that in between.
No.
He. There never was when he didn't know what you were going to pray. Kids will ask, gee, how could Papa hear? How could Papa? I'm the Papa, and I meant to say God, but maybe that's a Freudian slip. I don't know. But how could I am God to my kids? I don't know. But how could God, Papa? How could God hear all those prayers at once? The answer is he doesn't learn anything when he hears them.
Right.
There never was when he didn't know what was going to be prayed. That doesn't mean the prayers don't have effect. It's just that they had effect on God in eternity past, not at this moment when he said, oh, that's a good request. I think I'll go with it.
Right.
So prayer does work, but not because God figures out what you want when you pray it, and then he's got to decide on it.
Right.
All of the disputations of God regarding anything have been secured from time in eternity, and which would include election, but a whole bunch of other things as well.
Well, what's a good book or something I could really get into? Because I do consider you a mentor, and I really want to understand what what drives you, how you see uh-huh. the world. What good book could I get into about learning? The Reformed theology?
Well, there's two that come to mind, and I'm sure there are lots of good ones out there. Systematics, for example. I can never remember this. Wayne Grudem has a systematic that is Reformed, and so you're going to get a Reformed perspective there. It depends. If you want something just introductory, Michael Horton wrote a piece a long time ago called Putting Amazing Back into Grace.
Okay.
And this is about 20 years ago, and I don't know if it's still in print, but that's one that articulates the Reformed view. And then there's another one, and again, I don't know if this is in print anymore or not, but I think the title is Sinners in the Hands of a, is it Loving God? I know it's a takeoff on the
Angry God by Spurgeon?
No, no, that wasn't Spurgeon. That was the American guy. I can't remember his name, but the title is a takeoff on that sermon by the American evangelist thinker. Gee, what? Some names are just, it's like running into a wall when I try to recall. It's a very famous name. But in any event, everybody else is screaming it at their MP3 player right now because they all know what it is. But in any event, the title is a takeoff on the title of that famous sermon.
Oh.
Who? Oh, that's the other book. Okay, write that down for me. Clotfilter or something is the name of the guy who wrote this other book called Sinners in the Hands of a Loving God, I think is the name of it. And I'll get you it'll be tweeted. Melinda will get that. And if Amy's nice, she'll recall the name of that other American that we're trying. Sinners in the Hands of a Angry God was a famous sermon by this American colonialist that everybody else knows his name, but I can't think of it. But those two works, I think, are ones that will give you an introduction. Now, if you want a systematic that will keep you going for the rest of your life on this, it's a dogmatic theology by, I can't stand it when this happens. We're just going to have to tweet it. And when I get to break, my mind will clear, and I'll think of all of these names. The Dogmatics by, check the Twitter. In about
anything by Schaefer?
No, Francis Schaefer does not, I think, develop a theology like that. He has really good stuff, but I think his better stuff is on understanding the apologetic task in the face of a modernistic world, and many of what he says applies to a postmodern world as well. But he's not really a theologian. I mean, he's no slouch, obviously, but his strength is in another area. Shedd's Dogmatics, S-H-E-D-D, S-H-E-D-D, okay. Shedd's Dogmatic. I'm telling you, that is a really, really great volume, but it's dense. Forget about underlining anything because you're going to underline every sentence.
Okay.
You know, and the most recent edition that is edited by, Melinda, what's our professor from Talbot who edited Shedd's Dogmatics? Alan Gomes. Thank you. Alan Gomes. Oh, and I'm embarrassed. I forgot your name. Alan, I hope you're not listening, but if you are, I apologize. Alan Gomes, fabulous.
Give him an opportunity to practice his forgiveness.
Yeah, I give lots of people plenty of opportunity for that. So
you and me both.
Shedd's Dogmatics and then Putting Amazing Back into Grace, and also the one I mentioned, and I'll get the details on that at the break.
Okay.
For the Sinners in the Hands, I think it's of a Loving God, or maybe Mercy. You should be able to find it in Google pretty easily if it's still in print.
Okay,
that would be my recommendation.
And so the Age of Accountability is there, as far as we know, until the child knows enough
to be accountable.
To be accountable
before God, and then,
at that point, they are elected or not.
Well, no, they're either elected or not before already in the mind of God, you know, from eternity past. But if they are, if God has in his grace decided to show himself to them, you know, remember Jesus said, a lot of people don't like this idea, but Jesus said in, I just read it in Luke when he sent out the disciples in their short-term mission, he said, I thank you, Father, that you have shown these things to the babes, and not to the wise. It's the Father's good pleasure to reveal these things to the rebellious people he desires. And there are so many. I know a lot of people don't like the notion, but there's so many passages that seem to me can't be understood in any other way. John 6 has got quite a few, and John 10 does as well. But that's not the only place. There's lots of places.
But when the scriptures say things like "choose this day," "choose life," "I've set before you death and life," "choose life,"
yeah,
"choose this day whom you will serve." That's if the Lord has given them the ability to choose.
Well, they have an ability to choose. They are already making choices. And in the Reform position, there is an understanding of how choice works. And that is a largely intuitive notion. It's just that the libertarian freedom, which means you have the capability to do otherwise, it seems to me cannot apply to salvation straight up, because people are lost. They are completely lost in sin. They are unplugged from God. They are held captive by Satan to do his will. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. They are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. They are slave to their own fleshly desires. I mean, I could go on and on in terms of biblical anthropology. And so how do we get out of this mess? If we're enslaved, someone else has got to rescue us from slavery. Now, and so the choice that we always make is going to be against God unless God provides us the grace to choose otherwise. And what I think what the Arminian side wants to do, and I respect the Arminian side, but that what they want to do is declare that there is a, you know, God's prevenient grace kind of cancels out the effects of all of these things that I just described, such that puts them at a median point. The problem, and then it's even Stephen there, and they can make their libertarianly free choice to believe or not to believe. And all I can say is there is no such description anywhere in the scriptures that I know of that thing. The scriptures then wouldn't be describing people as no one seeks God, there's not one, that we have all this, that, and the other thing, and all these gruesome pictures. It would say, well, in the natural state, but all that's been canceled out by God. So everybody that you're going to talk to has been even Stephen. It never says anything, never hints that way. So I just can't go in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And so all the persuasion that Paul uses is for someone who's been graciously allowed to make a libertarian choice.
No, they're not making a libertarian choice, in my view. A libertarian choice means that you can choose A or not A. If God elects, that is it's an irresistible drawing. He works such in us that we come to him. There is no libertarian choice in the Calvinistic view of salvation. There may be choices that we make outside of that are libertarian, but not the salvation question. No one comes to me except those that the Father has given me. And of those that the Father gives me, I lose nothing, but I raise them up on the last day. I think that's John 6.
Libertarian choice when we're choosing what to eat for dinner.
Sure, I think so.
But we don't have libertarian choice when it comes to being to rejecting the Lord and sinning, or when he draws us to receive him.
I think that's what the scripture teaches.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is, I mean, some. I know that for a lot of people will sound like, well, that's really weird. And I said, well, like we don't have libertarian choice on the most important thing. And I'm saying that's what I think the scripture teaches, which shows the gravity of the rebellion of man against God. When man fell, he fell into deep slavery that had a number of facets. And so when I talked to you, when I mentioned, I just quoted two verses that talk about man's slavery. We are held captive by him to do his will. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one, and we are blinded. He has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. Three verses. One's in Timothy, one's in 2 Corinthians 4. Or maybe three, and the other one's in 1 John. I mean, that by itself is a teaching of the scripture that we are held captive, okay? But then you've got the flesh, then you've got spiritual death, then you've got slavery to sin, and it's the Son that sets free from that, slavery to sin. It's John 8. You've got all. So, yeah, I guess I'd have to say, in fidelity to the text, that seems the way it is. You can freely choose, in the libertarian sense, what you want to have for dinner. But when it comes to sin, you're a slave. You and I both are slaves, or we were. until we were rescued. And such were some of you, but you have been rescued. You've been saved. You've been washed. You've been cleansed, you know. But when the kindness of God, our Savior, appeared, he saved us. That's Titus 3. So anyway, I'm sympathetic to people go the other way. Here I stand. I can do no other in light of the texts that we're facing.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. I'm sure you appreciate that.
Thank you for your call, Chris. I took a little extra time on this one. It was a good one, though. And can we go quickly to a break here, shall we? And then we'll get to Kevin in Lakewood here before the end of the hour. Stay with us on Stand to Reason.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
All right, friends. Thank you, Amy Hall, who has the helped me with a couple things. Jonathan Edwards was the colonial American, probably made the greatest contribution of any American to theology. That's the name I could not remember. Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was his sermon. And I know a multitude of you are finally breathing a sigh of relief. I'm glad that idiot figured that out, Jonathan Edwards. Okay. The other title that I was recommending is titled Sinners in the Hands of a Good God. Sinners in the Hands of a Good God. The author is David Clotfelter, Clotfelter. Find it on Twitter and also on blog post tomorrow. And that is still in print, by the way. You can get it at Amazon. And it's an excellent book. So, okay, let's quickly go to Kevin. Hello, Kevin. Thank you for waiting.
Hello. Good to talk to you, Greg Kogel.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Great. I have two questions. I don't know if we have time to get to both.
Let's see what we can do.
Okay. My first question is, I have a friend, and I think I understand the problem in this reasoning, but I was wondering if I can hear how you would approach a situation like this.
Okay.
And that is that he says, it's kind of a debate on objective truth.
Uh-huh.
And so he says, and I think it's right to an extent, that there is an objective truth in the natural phenomenal world.
Uh-huh.
So there is an objectivity to it, but everyone has to interpret for themselves.
That's so right.
Subjectivity there.
Well, okay. I can tell you the problem right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because this comes up all the time, and in fact, my very, very first debate on relativism with a PhD in anthropology, she made the same mistake, Professor Magliocco over at Cal State University, Northridge. And she was saying, of course, all moral truth is subjective because it comes from subjects. And so that would make it a subjective truth. And now she's guilty here of equivocation. And it is a mistake that no PhD should ever make. Equivocation is when a word is used, has two different definitions, and the definitions are mixed up in the use of the word. And so you end up with faulty lines of reasoning because when you use the word in the first case, you mean one definition. But when you use the word in the second case, you mean the second definition. Like, for example, I heard a guy argue against, let's say, school vouchers. And he said public funds for public education. Not for private education, public funds for public education. But see, there's an equivocation. Because in the first case, the word public meant from the people. People from the public, funds from the public, that is from the people. In the second case, the word public meant government sponsored. And so he made a rhetorically appealing argument that was fallacious because of the equivocation. If he wanted to avoid it, he should have said money from the people that goes for education for the people. But of course, that would have endorsed vouchers, you know, which wasn't the idea he wanted to endorse. But he was guilty of equivocation. The same thing is true here. What does subjective mean? Well, a subjective statement could be any statement from a subject, that is a person. A subjective truth is one that is grounded in the subject, that it is true in virtue of the subject's belief. Okay, so let me ask you a question. Is grass green?
Yes.
Yeah, well, just for the sake of discussion, mine is a little bit brown right now, but yes. Okay, when we say grass is green, are we describing something inside of us, or are we describing something that's true of grass? Well, we mean to be describing, I think, that's a quality that's predicated of grass, and therefore this is an objective statement, even though a subject is making the statement. The statement is about the object, and its truth is secured by some detail of the object. So if grass is green, it's a true statement. Even if I don't believe it, even if I said, no, that's a false statement, it still would be true objectively, all right? Now, if I say, you know, that abortion is wrong for me, what I'm probably implying when people say that is that they don't believe it's right, but someone else might believe it's right. It's right for them. But of course, now the truth value of the statement of abortion is wrong, or right for that matter, is going to be grounded in a subject. It's not grounded in abortion. And so different subjects can have different points of view. Now, in case I went too fast with that, two things I want to say. Do you receive solid ground?
I did. I don't know. I don't think I do anymore.
Well, sign up for it right away. Go to str.org. Just sign up. It'll be free. Just reactivate.
Absolutely.
Because May 1st, you're going to get a solid ground where I go into a lot of detail about this difference.
Okay.
And it'll be really, really clear. here's another illustration for this. Golf and gravity. Okay, whatever gravity amounts to, it's not man-made. It's a feature of the world. Now, I, as a human subject, might define gravity in a certain way, but that doesn't mean I am making it up for me, and you can define it the way you want to. And gravity is different for every different person because it's only subjective. No, gravity is a feature of the world, even though subjects are the ones who discover it and describe it. It is not a subjective truth in the sense that it's just up to me. Golf, on the other hand, is up to people. We invented that. And frankly, you can go to different golf courses and maybe they have different house rules, you know, the way you, you know, play certain. I don't play golf, so I don't know the variations, but there may be variations of rules in golf because we can change the rules. It's up to us. So your friend, to go back to your friend, the problem there was that he was using the word subjective in two different ways. I, as a subject, can make a statement that is true for the object, and if true, and if regarding the object, it's an objective claim. Now, I might be mistaken, but I'm making the claim about the object. And so it's an objective kind of claim, which is either true or false. Subjective claims are neither true or false. As long as they're true for you, then they're true. That's it. Doesn't have anything to do with reality. It just has to do with your own feelings. And your friend or whoever it is that you engaged with on this particular question is just mixing up those two definitions.
Very, very good. In regards to communicate this further, if he was to respond by saying, well, that is itself a interpretation, how would you tactfully go about
it? It's not an interpretation. It's a definition.
Okay.
When it's a definition, it's not an interpretation. Objective statements are statements whose truth is secured by the object. The object is the truth maker. All right? Or to put another way, the truth of the statement is mind independent. That's the definition of an objective truth. You can't just, okay, no, I'm not going to, oh, that's your interpretation. I'm going to define objective truth to be, you know, a green banana. Well, okay, all right, you can redefine it if you want, but then nobody's going to be able to communicate. That's the definition. A subjective truth is a truth that is mind-dependent and is grounded, the truth maker is in the belief of the subject, and it has nothing to do with the object. That's the distinctions. Now, if that person doesn't like that, then he should talk about, you know, baseball or basketball or fishing or something else, but he shouldn't talk about philosophy because he's not willing to use the definitions that are appropriate for the conversation.
For sure. Cool.
And by the way, it's self-refuting what he's saying, because the minute he says, well, that is an interpretation and that's a subjective truth, he has made an objective claim about your statement.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can say, no, all you're telling me is about your subject claim about my beliefs. So if you want to apply the same standard to him, he can never make any statements about anybody else, not even ones that, yeah, that's a subjective statement. Well, you can't play that way. You've already disqualified yourself from this conversation. Did you follow that last point?
I did, and that's the direction I was planning on going. Just wanted to check on I very much look up to you and your tactics, so I wanted to see how you would tactfully respond. But something like that would be how I would.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, challenge him on it. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You have the last thing. It says, uncle is in a same-sex marriage. Call husband or uncle. I got like 1 minute. Do I have a minute? Yeah, I think I have a minute. What was exactly the question for that?
Yeah. I have an uncle. I love him dearly. He's married to another man.
Yes.
Homosexual. And as far as I know, they are legally married. And so I'm looking for, I was wondering if I can get your wisdom on how to, refer to the spouse. He's a friend of the families at this point, you know, and I look up to
him. I would refer to him as his partner. For the sake of time here, I'm just jumping in. That's what I would refer to him as. And just because the government says that he's at some level has said that he's a husband doesn't mean I got to call him that way. I think it's a contradiction of terms. A husband is a male married to a woman, not to another man. They're in a partnership relationship, but why does the government have to force me to use their terminology?
Okay, so you don't think I should you wouldn't recommend me calling him uncle then?
Well, yeah, you say if his name is Fred, say Uncle Fred, not Husband Fred.
Okay.
Just your terminology with regards to your uncle, I don't think has to change. Your terminology with regards to his partner, I think you just call him, make reference to him as his partner or whatever. And if you're introducing to somebody else, you say, here's my Uncle Sam and here's Fred.
Okay.
You can make your own. You don't have to go, in my view. Now, if they make a fuss about it, to me, that's bad manners. But doesn't mean they won't make a fuss. All right, Kev?
Okay. Thank you so much for your help.
Yeah, you're welcome. Very good questions. I love answering questions like that, or at least trying to answer them. And if you guys didn't follow entirely the issue of subjective-objective, be sure you're signed up for Solid Ground, and that's coming out in May, a whole article that entails that as part of a larger argument. I'm Greg Kokel, hour number two, just ahead. Stay with us. All right, new hour upon us. Sometimes I hate to say second hour because for Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel, because I don't know if this is the second hour any particular market is getting. Of course, if I say second hour, it's your first, then you feel like you missed something, and maybe you get the podcast at str.org or iTunes. Anyway, this is our second hour, all right? Another hour, which is our second. And I have so much to say here. I hope I can keep it down to one segment because there are a lot of people on board that I want to get to and I'm looking forward to talking to. But let me start out this way. Two weeks ago today, last week I was gone, so this is the first time back since my comments on World Vision, who had offered a very convoluted kind of argument why as an organization they were, after a fashion, embracing same-sex married couples as those who were legitimate followers of Jesus Christ and therefore could be employed by their organization. And I think they got themselves into a bind because they're in the state of Washington and they had probably some homosexuals that were in the closet. And the question about whether being gay and being a follower of Christ, if that was consistent or not, hadn't come up because they weren't public. But then when same-sex marriage was legalized in that state, then some of them got married and then they did become public. Now what? Should they fire them? Well, if they don't fire them because they're members in good standing in all other ways, then what are they going to do with other same-sex couples who are married who are applying? If they don't accept them, then there's not parity there. And it just seemed like this internally, I mean, I'm making some judgments about what was actually going on, but it seems like this was the case. Internally, this created a lot of upheaval. And so in order to keep the peace, they just decided, well, we know we want everybody to be a follower of Christ who works for our Christian ministry organization, and the moral obligations regarding sexuality is that you retain sex for inside of marriage, and these people are married, so they kind of fit the bill, and so we're just going to change our hiring practices. And of course, this created a maelstrom of response. I weighed in the day after this happened and talked about how convoluted it was and how, from a strategic perspective, it was really unfortunate to lose World Vision to this, because in the past that they have, this 500-pound gorilla, so to speak, had been worth $1 billion or something, or maybe more, maybe a lot more. They'd been on our side, and they'd fought against this U.S. government, went to the Supreme Court, and won, and so now they're caving in for what? Anyway, I registered my concern, and so did a whole lot of other people, by the way. And the day after the show, they came out with a statement that they reversed their decision. And part of the objection that was raised is they're an organization who believes that the Bible is inerrant word of God and this is the guide. And it seemed like in this decision they were disregarding the authority of the Bible as their guide. And I raised the objection. I don't know how much this kind of thing resonated with them, but I don't see how somebody who is living an active gay lifestyle can in any way, shape, or form be considered a committed follower of Christ any way than somebody leading a committed adulterous lifestyle can be considered that. In any event, the combination of factors and the deluge of mail and calls that they got, and I think Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, wrote a letter and said, our organization is never going to make this kind of compromise at World Vision. They had a change of heart. Now, I think their reason to go to change their policy in favor or what appeared to be in favor of same-sex marriage, though they were part of the convoluted statement, was that they were not actually promoting same-sex marriage or affirming it, but it seemed that they were. In any event, the decision to go astray was convoluted. But the decision to change their mind to land back on their feet, fortunately, was not. It was straightforward. And they were beating their breast and citing their mea culpas, and we made a mistake. We humbly ask for your forgiveness. We failed to be consistent with World Vision's U.S. commitment to the traditional understanding of biblical marriage and our own statement of faith, which says we believe the Bible to be the inspired, the only infallible, authoritative Word of God, et cetera, et cetera. So we are brokenhearted over the pain and confusion we've caused many of our friends. And I accept the apology, not that they were making it to me personally, but fine, we all make mistakes. And I think the spirit with which they changed their point of view was really a good one, and their rationale was really sound. And though I know the left was not happy with it, I think that it was a principled action consistent with their statement of faith and their commitment as a biblically grounded Christian ministry organization. All right. So that's a victory. Now, by contrast, in the last, say, week, there has been another upheaval in corporate America. Some of you might, who follow the whole digital deal, might be familiar with the name Brendan Eich, apparently a significant player in flash technology, and had been the CEO of Mozilla, who founded or created the Firefox browser, which some of you might use. And he was somebody that was, he's a significant player in his field. Well, it turns out that when Prop 8 was in play in the state of California, and if you recall, Proposition 8 was, I think, a constitutional amendment where the general population, through a popular initiative, got to vote whether we would amend the Constitution to make it clear that in the state of California, they recognized only conjugal marriage, male-female marriage, as real marriage. During that time, which passed, by the way, and then got pounced on by the courts soon after, the Brendan Eich, CEO of Mozilla, had made a contribution of $1,000 to that enterprise. What is it, 6 years ago when it came out? And 4 years ago or so, the Los Angeles Times, published a list of everyone who had given money regarding Prop 8, either for or again, and how much money they gave, and who their employer was, and where they lived, what zip code and city. Now, why the LA Times, champion of privacy and choice when it comes to abortion, could justify flushing all of these people out into the open who made private political contributions, which at the time was consistent with the point of view of the president of the United States, Barack Obama. Why they feel justified in doing such a thing is beyond me. This to me is another example of what's yours is mine. I'm sorry, what mine is mine and what yours is mine too. That is, we want our stuff, but when the same rules that we apply to us apply to you, well, they don't apply to you. So we want our stuff private, but then when you're against us, we're going to flush you out in the open so we can hurt you. And anyway, that's a separate topic, but that seems to be what took place. And somewhere down the line, Brendan Eich's name surfaced as somebody who had supported Prop 8. And what has been going on in the last, 10 years, increasing in momentum, is a brutal bullying from the left regarding the issue of homosexuality. It started right after Prop 8 because names started coming out, and people who were involved in supporting Prop 8 started getting hurt. No, look, at if you know somebody who supported Prop 8 and they own a business in town, you have the liberty not to go there if you don't want to. And I get you have the liberty to do a boycott. But a lot of this was private information about their support. They got flushed out into the open, first of all. So there's a violation of privacy there, it seems to me, that's significant. But secondly, it's one thing to say you're not going to take your business somewhere where you don't like the politics of the person who runs the business. It is something entirely different when the business itself puts pressure on its employees because of a vote that they made or a contribution that they made and forces them out of business or threatens to fire them because they don't have the right politics. And this is what happened with Brendan Eich, because in the last few days, I guess the last few weeks, Brendan Eich, under pressure, now he didn't get fired, strictly speaking, but there is no question that all the pressure that was put on him resulted in his resigning his role as CEO of Mozilla. Now, what is amazing to me about this action is the unbelievable, and I'm just going to call it Orwellian doublespeak for those of you who are marginally educated and know what that phrase means, how much Orwellian doublespeak is part of this whole transaction. Because, by the way, George Orwell wrote a book called 1984 that it might be a good idea for, you know, anybody who thinks themselves reasonably educated to read. 1984 is way past us. He wrote it when 1984 was in the future, but he talked about an oppressive government. Big Brother, that term comes from Orwell. And so does the term doublespeak, where you have words turn out to mean exactly the opposite of what they sound like they mean. That's doublespeak. And this is what we see with the ousting of Brendan Eich. It is what I call the intolerance of tolerance. And if you have not read that piece that I wrote, you can probably find it on the internet. I wrote it for Breakpoint probably 8-10 years ago, and I think it may be on our website. And I give a talk on the intolerance of tolerance all the time. Now, that title has been picked up by D.A. Carson in a book in which he probably explores the idea, but I had the title first. I'm glad he's using it. It's not copyrightable. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying you probably run across his book when you Google it, but I hope you find my piece too because it's shorter. It makes the same point that what is called tolerance now used to be called intolerance, and what is called intolerance right now used to be called tolerance. Now, in other words, the definitions have gone topsy-turvy, but since tolerance is a connotation word, that is, it has a feeling associated with it, when somebody co-opts the word for its opposite meaning, it still sounds like a virtue. Tolerance used to mean you are egalitarian about people and elitist about ideas. That is, and this is Peter Kreft's characterization, but I think it captures it good. That means you treat people with respect and dignity regardless of their point of view. You give them a free opportunity to speak and hold their own views. You tolerate them. Put up with them, if you want to think of it that way, but that's what tolerance is. But when it comes to ideas, some ideas are better than others. They're not all equal. Human beings are equal in value, but ideas aren't. And therefore, we should have the tolerance of people that allows us to then knock the ideas around in the public square so we can figure out which ones are good and which ones are bad. But see, that's over with now. Because in the last 20 years, it's flipped on its head. Now, all ideas are equally valuable, like all the ideas that used to be considered bizarre. No, these are all good ideas. These are fine. And if you object to them, then you're intolerant. And because you have a principled objection to some of these, people could then call you names. Now, is this an environment now where the best idea wins anymore? No, because the person who holds the politically incorrect view ends up getting ridiculed right off the stage. Does anyone know what Brendan Eich's reasons were for supporting Prop 8 and not supporting same-sex marriage? Does anybody care? They don't. If you don't support, you are a bigot. That's doublespeak again, because bigotry is a unreasonable hatred for a group of people or unreasonable intolerance of them. Well, there's nothing unreasonable about being against same-sex marriage. There's a rationale offered for that. And there's no evidence of hate at all, in simply in virtue of the fact that you're against same-sex marriage. And there's no evidence of hate in Brendan Eich. And his own superiors, or others on the, because he was the CEO, so the others on his, his organization acknowledged that. Now, let me see if I can find the citation here. Here it is. Mozilla Executive Chairwoman Mitchell Baker admitted in an interview that she had not known about Eich's views on gay marriage throughout most of their working relationship until the donation came to light last year. In other words, somebody flushed that out. And here's what she said. That was shocking to me because I never saw any kind of behavior or attitude from him that was not in line with Mozilla's values of inclusiveness. In other words, this man, regardless of his own personal views for or again same-sex marriage, had no influence on the way that he conducted himself with Mozilla's employees or how well or consistently he supported the mission and values of Mozilla. He was a model student, a model player. He did nothing wrong. She says, I was shocked to find out, and here's the subtext, that all the time that he was acting like a really nice, inclusive person, he was a bigot in disguise. And we learned that when we found out that he gave money to this enterprise. So it's clear that there was nothing in his behavior that disqualified him that was related to Mozilla's values or to their mission that justified them muscling him out of office. He was a model employee in this regard. It was that he had the wrong view on this issue. And so they could do whatever they wanted to this dear man, who wrote a piece saying all the things that he was going to do to kind of cooperate with the notion of inclusiveness at Mozilla. He said, here are my commitments. Here's what you can expect. And he gives all these participations with LGBT communities and allies to listen and to learn, to be commit himself to community participation guidelines, our inclusive health benefits, our anti-discrimination policies, my personal commitment to work on the new initiatives to reach out to those who feel excluded, who have been marginalized. He's over and over again. And then he says, and then in the meantime, I want to express my sorrow at having caused pain. He didn't cause any pain. These people weren't doubling over with anguish because he voted in favor of Prop 8. They were angry. But here he is, bending over backwards, and this wasn't enough. No, they wanted his head, and they got it. And what's really, I mean, talk about Orwellian doublespeak. What's really amazing to me is the language that was used by Mozilla and GLAAD in this particular case in response to what they learned and their action to get rid of this person. And I'm just going to read a couple lines. They start this piece by saying Mozilla prides itself on being held to a different standard. And this past week, we didn't live up to it. We know why people are hurt and angry, and they're right. It's because we haven't stayed true to ourselves. Okay, what is it that they didn't stay true to? And you read down a little bit further, and here's what it says. And fasten your seatbelts, okay? And those of you who are familiar with George Orwell, you know, here comes the doublespeak. Here it is. Our organizational culture reflects diversity and inclusiveness. We welcome contributions from everyone. regardless of age, culture, ethnicity, gender, gender identity, language, race, sexual orientation, geographical location, religious views, Mozilla supports equality for all. We have employees with a wide diversity of views. By the way, I'm quoting here. Our culture of openness extends to encouraging staff and community to share their beliefs and opinions in public. Oh, yeah? In other words, they are open to every belief that is consistent with their own views. Apparently, they are not open to the belief that somebody may have principled objections against same-sex marriage. And there are fabulous arguments that are raised against that that have absolutely nothing to do with hatred or animosity against homosexuals. Some people might have that as a motivation, but you have to look not at the motivation, you got to look at the reasons, whether the reasons are good or not. And Mozilla has the audacity to say that we support equality for all. GLAAD's response was this. That would be GLAAD, which is a pro-gay organization. Mozilla's strong statement in favor of equality today reflects where corporate America is: inclusive, safe, and welcoming to all. Is that a joke or what? Does Brenton Ike feel safe, included, and welcomed? It's Orwellian doublespeak. Now, I never thought. Oh, yeah, I already read that. I never thought I would hear myself saying this, but thank God for Andrew Sullivan, gay activist Andrew Sullivan. Thank God for him, because he wrote a piece in response to this, and what he said made sense. Here's how he started. The guy who had the gall to express his First Amendment rights in favor of Prop 8 in California by donating $1,000 has just been scalped by some gay activists. Now, remember, Andrew Sullivan is probably, arguably, the most well-known and broadly read gay activist in the United States of America, and he's been around for a long time. And he says that this whole episode disgusts me, as it should disgust anyone interested in a tolerant and diverse society. If this is the gay rights movement today, hounding our opponents with a fanaticism more like the religious right than anyone else, then count me out. If we are about intimidating the free speech of others, we are no better than the anti-gay bullies who came before us. And this is bullying. Make no mistake about it. So, now let me just close my thoughts here. And we'll take a break, and then we'll go to calls. Oh, incidentally, here's a little tweet. A guy named Brian Hall tweeted, "The new Mozilla values statement, burn the witch." And Mozilla responds, this is April 3rd, Mozilla responds to him and says, "We are an organization that believes in openness and that no one should be persecuted for the beliefs they hold, no matter what they are." And they said that with a straight face. Amy Hall, by the way, at Stand to Reason, has written a fabulous piece on that. You can get it at str.org on our blog. I mentioned what Andrew Sullivan said. Now, here's my application. Okay, friends, listeners. Friends, Romans, countrymen, we have to stand up to the bullies. These people are bullies. And this is one reason why I'm really glad that World Vision reversed its opinion, its decision. So we've got World Vision that's, you know, back in play here. Thank you, Phil Robertson and the whole Robertson family with Duck Dynasty for standing up. And when A&E was going to bounce Phil Robertson because he made some remark about the questionableness of or the immorality of homosexuality, and he's even misquoted the way for that interview in Esquire magazine. Nevertheless, so he's misrepresented, and there's a big hue and cry, and so they're going to get rid of him because he's just not politically correct. And Phil Robertson and the rest of the family says, "Oh, okay, we don't need you. We're going to rethink our whole commitment to you guys because we don't need you. We're going to be faithful to Christ first, not to you guys. and to ratings. It turned out there were thousands of letters that came in, and a couple days later, they totally reversed. A&E reversed their position. So we need people, big and small, to say to the bullies, absolutely not. The more we let the bullies bully, the bigger and more bold the bullies get. And this is going to be happening to more and more people. When are we just going to say no to these people? And then respond with, here are my principal reasons against same-sex marriage and stand to reasons. Put this all together in a piece called The Same-Sex Marriage Quick Reference Guide. It's all there for you. It's just one laminated page. Easy, $4.95 on a website. Okay, and I'm not trying to make a sales pitch here. I want you to have this material. We've got other things you can download at str.org for free that I've done in the past. But you got to be able to respond now. Look, I'm not a bigot. I think this is a bad idea. And one of the reasons it's a bad idea is as soon as this stuff becomes law, we start losing our individual freedoms. How do I know? Because it's already happening before it's even law. You think it's going to get easier? We give in to these guys. We appease these people. And then they start passing more laws. What's going to happen when the government is going to be enforcing this stuff? And it's already happening in the states where same-sex marriage is legal. Loss of religious liberty, loss of individual freedom, loss of parental rights. And this is an individual freedom right here. This guy lost his job. And, I mean, and this guy's this guy is like Mr. Internet, Brendan Eich. If not even Brendan Eich can escape this, do you think you're going to be able to escape this? No. And so when it happens to us, we don't give in. We don't fold. We don't appease. We say to the bullies, no. And if we don't say no to the bullies, they get stronger and they're going to bully us on more things. It's just time to draw a line in the sand, and that line is called faithfulness, and we're just going to say no. And read over Matthew 10, when Jesus warned the disciples when he sent them out what was going to happen to them. It's happening here now. It happened to them. It's happening to us. He said, they did it to me. They'll do it to you, because the student isn't greater than his teacher. And when he talked about the hardship and difficulty they would face in the cultures they would go to be faithful to Christ, he says three times, do not fear them. Do not fear them. Do not fear them. Don't miss that. I've mentioned it here before on the radio with regards to this issue and other things like it. Do not fear them. That's from Jesus. So are we going to take our marching orders from Jesus? Or are we going to take it from Mozilla and GLAAD and LGBTQ and whatever else they come up with next time? Are we going to take that? Or are we going to stand up as good ambassadors and say no in a winsome and attractive way and tell them why? That's our job. Okay, off to break and your calls after this. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-5 4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and stand to reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, that's the show, that's the host, and not in that order, but the fear of man is a snare. Book of Proverbs says, the fear of man is a snare. Decide here and now how you are going to respond when you get pushed on this. I hope you do it diplomatically as a good ambassador for Christ, but I hope you don't get pushed over. You don't decide here and now, because it's coming. It's coming for every single one of you. If somebody calls you a bigot, you ask for a definition. If somebody calls you intolerant, you ask for the definition. If somebody says that you hate homosexuals because of you're not in favor of same-sex marriage, then you get out, you reflect on what you learned in the same-sex marriage quick reference guide, and you say, no, it's not, has nothing to do with hate. It has to do with a thoughtful assessment of the issue. You want to hear about it? You might want to ask them the question, what is the essential public purpose of marriage? Why does the government give marriage licenses to begin with? I'll tell you why they give it. Because as a rule, as a group, and by nature, long-term heterosexual unions produce the next generation. If that weren't the case, then they wouldn't be involved. Anyway, on that, we got like 9 different basic challenges that people have raised to those with our position and how to answer that. It's a great resource. Need to go back to you. Let's talk with Stephen in Ohio. Hello, Stephen. Glad to have you on board.
Hi, Greg. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, sir.
Hey, long-time listener, first-time caller. I have a question for you about a Catholic doctrine, specifically on their teaching of contraceptives.
Uh-huh.
I have a good friend who converted to Catholicism the past couple years, well thought, well read, so it always makes for some really interesting conversations. I'm still firmly in the Protestant world. Recently, we've begun
talking
about...
That's good news as far as I'm concerned, by the way.
Yeah. recently, we started talking about their Catholics' teaching on contraceptives, For me, not having a lot of conversations with Catholics, it's a relatively new conversation for me, so I have a little difficulty responding. And I assume that you are familiar with their teachings.
I am.
My question is, how do I, as a Protestant, respond to these thoughts? Because basically, he's talking about, or he's referring to, natural law and God's intent and purpose for sexuality having a dual role, which is procreation and unity, and to split those apart is not only just sinful, but it's a mortal sin. So any contraceptives are therefore immoral.
Well, the idea of mortal sin in general is ludicrous, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this is a different issue. That
sure.
Masturbation is a mortal sin. Missing church on Sunday is a mortal sin. Eating. Well, it used to be eating meat on Friday was a mortal sin. Now they've reduced that to a misdemeanor. And if it looks like I'm making a joke here, I am, because it strikes me as just obviously silly.
Sure.
And that was George Carlin joke anyway. But I think he was on the money there. You know, these are the things that if you die with a mortal sin unconfessed in your soul, you go straight to hell on their accounting of how sin and salvation works. And that somebody would go straight to hell for... Well, this just strikes me as bizarre. All sin is mortal unless it's forgiven.
Sure.
Then it's forgiven, and it's forgiven completely. So we have very different understandings of how this works. But that aside, it's clear in their view that there is a natural teleology to sexuality that they argue should not be interfered with in any way, shape, or form, and any interference with that sexuality is going to violate a principle of God what God intended for it, and therefore it's a sin, it's wrong, but in some of these are really egregious sins according to their reckoning.
Sure.
I just have never been persuaded by that. I mean, clearly the Scripture doesn't say, doesn't make these particular points. Did God intend men for women and women for men sexually? Yes, it says that explicitly. And it says if that intention is abridged in some sense, if men go with men and women with women, well, this is a serious crime because there has been an abandonment of that person or one or provision that God has made for our sexuality. And that's very clear. It's clear from early Genesis. It's clear in Levitical law. It's clear in the book of Romans. But, okay, well, that's clear. But the idea that there is something kind of sacrosanct about the whole system of procreation such that if you interfere at any point, and that interference might be, say, coitus interruptus, for example, where there's you don't complete the sexual act joined together, but outside or masturbation, even if it's mutual, during an intimate engagement with someone, and also using any kind of birth control that isn't what they call natural birth control, and the distinction there sometimes is. It seems to me a little bit foggy. Yes. And so then these things are really wrong. In vitro fertilization, that is, if you're having a difficulty, then doing a medical process that's meant to overcome the difficulty and restore the natural function is also considered wrong, according to their understanding of natural law in this regard. I just personally have never been persuaded by any of those arguments, and so consequently I don't have to answer any of them. They just seem unpersuasive to me. What are lips for? Are lips made for kissing? Or are they made for articulating words and made for eating? Then we can use them to kiss? What are we made to kiss? Well, there is kissing that goes on in the Bible. Kissing's okay, but you know, if you things seem to me to have multiple purposes, and if a person is deeply convinced that interfering with the natural flow of things sexually, such that you have any kind of sexual contact that comes to a physical climax that doesn't at least have the possibility of procreation, then you're sinning. Well, then I think you should follow your conscience. But I'm not in the least bit persuaded by any of that. And so,
sure.
So I don't feel like I have a strong need to answer the argument because the argument doesn't seem to be persuasive out of the gate.
So basically, maybe you're counter argument back would be that just because something has a purpose or has multiple purposes doesn't mean that, well, just because something has more than one purpose doesn't mean that you can use that thing for one purpose and not for the other. You don't have to fulfill all the purposes at the same time.
Sure, sure. I think
okay,
that there's
sure.
there is the unitive function, and that the Catholics will use that word, and that is that there is a communion that is accomplished through the sexual act that is really important. Why can't we use this act to accomplish that end, even if it's not going to accomplish a procreative end, or at least potentially accomplish that end? I just don't follow the logic there. And when they carry it to you, now you can't even do any reproductive technology because. If you know, my wife had in vitro fertilization. We also adopted embryos, so we're trying to give life to embryos. We're trying to accomplish the design purpose that God had for us when our equipment wasn't operating as well as it used to. Why is that wrong? I mean, the reason that's given just doesn't compel me. That's all I would say. But that
Absolutely.
The way you summed it up, I think that that's certainly adequate.
Okay.
And,
that's really helpful. Because again, the way he describes it, you know, it sounds compelling because you know he's talking about If we talk about what sin is at its very nature, or at its very center, has to do with God's intent and God's purpose and it being violated, you know, we could talk, we could describe sin that way. And so I find it difficult to respond back when he's talking about the purpose of sexuality.
Well, this presumes
like, oh,
that
man,
we,
yeah, right.
But this presumes that we're violating it.
Yeah,
man
exactly.
was made for woman, so when he goes with a man the way he should be with a woman, then he is violating that, and it's explicitly stated in Romans 1. They reject the natural function of the woman and burned in desire towards one another. It's very explicit in the New American Standard. They reject the natural function of the woman. But look at mouths are for eating, right? Salivating and chewing and all that's part of eating. What about chewing gum? What do you do when you chew gum? You're keeping your mouth busy and having something that's tasty. You're salivating and chewing and doing all that stuff, but you don't swallow the gum to satisfy.
You're not getting sustenance from it then.
No, you spit it out, you know, or stick it to the underside of the table or something. But for some reason, my six-year-old is fascinated with gum under the table. You know, we've had to work on that with her. I guess that's
not
what
you want to put in your mouth.
Yeah, that may be not unusual for little kids. I don't know, but why isn't that a violation in the same way? I mean, there's a lot of counterexamples I think that can be given. Your eyes are for seeing. What about wearing glasses? So you're correcting a failure of the eyes. If one were to follow that in a certain sense, kind of religiously, I think you'd run into a lot of bizarre situations. So I just all I could say is it doesn't resonate with me. I don't think it's a sound line of thinking. And that isn't to say there aren't some lines of thinking that aren't that wouldn't apply to. Yeah, they are, and I think the homosexual one is an example of that, but that's also explicitly stated. You know, so
yep.
and homosexuality is forbidden. Bestiality is forbidden. But there is no sex that is forbidden between a husband and a wife.
Yeah.
So everything that is forbidden is outside of the marriage relationship, and inside of the marriage relationship, there's nothing but positive things that are said. So why? So doesn't that mean anything? Isn't that it's suggestive, I guess, is what I was
meaning. Yeah, that was a really good way of putting it. I'm trying to jot it down. The no sex is forbidden between a husband and a wife. I think that is
correct. The only really thing, common. All the things that are forbidden are types of sex with someone other than your genetically your gender different spouse, and I have to say that now because somebody said, "Well, then if homosexuals
sure.
can get married, then
yeah."
So you know what I'm talking about. Does that help, Stephen?
Absolutely. And hey, I have a real short question. You could probably answer it in like 10 seconds. Could I ask it real quick? I know you have other callers.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Do you know? The same conversations with the same friend, he has brought up a topic that I was curious if you had any resources on or you knew any authors or any places I could go to look for. He's talking about Catholic distributism, their political and economic system of the Catholic Church. And I've read a few of the books.
Distributism? Is that, did you say distributism?
Yeah.
I have never heard that phrase before. So there's a
quick answer. Do you know of any authors or any institutes that would most likely deal with that, especially from a Christian perspective, that might be offer critique of it, or you know where to point me?
Of course, the Roman Catholic would take exception when you said to critique one of their views from a Christian perspective. But okay,
I'm sure.
Yeah, so having said that, and I'm not suggesting that Roman Catholics are not Christian, you know, but I understand what you mean. Like a counterpoint, a religious counterpoint. I don't even know what the thing is, so I can't recommend it. I don't know. Maybe Amy Hall, who's listening right now, might know something about it and might blog something tomorrow. Or maybe something will show up on Twitter here later on. But I don't even know what that is. So I've never heard the term before, so I can't help you. So, yes, it is a question I can answer quickly. I don't know.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Stephen. I appreciate your call, too. Let's go to Garrett in Augusta, Georgia. Let me get your button here. Garrett, hi.
Hi. How you doing, Greg?
I'm fine. Thank you. Got a little wound up here earlier in the show.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Rightfully so.
Yeah, I think so. So what's on your mind today?
My question is, I'm kind of new to Reformed theology, mm-hmm. and I'm learning as much as I can about it. Reading a lot of Spurgeon, reading a lot of Jonathan Edwards and such. Uh-huh. And I have a question about free will, as to do with Reformed theology, because my background before was more Arminian.
Okay.
And I kind of had more of a thought about free will as, you know, we have a choice to receive or reject the gospel and all that. And I understand now about with election and predestination and all that. But where can you tell me what kind of the line is in dealing with free will,
uh-huh.
and where it's not sort of a determinism?
Uh-huh.
You know, with Reformed theology.
Yeah, well, some people would argue that Reformed theology is determinism.
Right.
There are characteristically three categories that are given here, and that is what's called determinism, where you just think it's like dominoes falling, okay?
Right.
Philosophers call it event causation, all right? One event causes another event causes it. There's no choices made at all. Secondly, is there a thing called compatibilism or also soft determinism?
Right.
And then there's a view called a libertarian free will. So let me distinguish between the second and the third. There are two different ways to understand the freedom project, if you will. And this is important that I get to say this because a lot of people think, well, if you're a Calvinist, you don't believe in free will. And I think that is a mischaracterization. Jonathan Edwards' characterization of free will, for example, and I just know this because other people have told me, not because I've read Edwards. He's too difficult for me. And if you're managing him, then I tip my hat to you. But the Jonathan Edwards' understanding of freedom is that essentially you do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you do what you want to do, that no one is compelling you to do it, but you are doing what your desire is, then that's considered freedom. Now, I think that resonates with a lot of people. I'm not forcing you to call me. You're calling me because you want to.
Right.
Now, Bill Craig has pointed out that that is a kind of determinism. I'm not sure if I totally agree with him, but I'll toss that out. It is
okay.
Called soft determinism or compatibilism, and compatibilism means that free will and determinism are made compatible with each other, and this is the way it's done. You do what you want to do. So when a man sins, God holds that person responsible for his sin, even though he is sinning according to his nature. It is his sin nature that drives his desire to sin, and then he fulfills his desire by choosing to sin, and he is held responsible for that choice. I don't know any Orthodox Christians, and I mean small o here, not the denomination, but people who are within the pale of Christianity, who says that human beings have the choice either to sin or not to sin. That's what Pelagius thought in the 4th century,
right.
But that he's a heretic. Orthodoxy
right.
says we are fallen from birth, and our fallen nature dictates our sinful actions, and that we will suppress the truth and unrighteousness. Now, those are things we want to do because our will is bent towards rebellion and sin. So we are choosing those things, but they are consistent with our fallenness. And so God is holding us responsible for that. Now, there is a second definition. First definition here, Edwards' definition. Freedom is doing what we want to do. The second definition adds another criterion. We do what we want to do, and we have to have the capability of doing otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have the freedom to do otherwise. Now, this is called by philosophers the could have done otherwise condition, or simply CDO. If the CDO condition is not met, then it's not true freedom. If it is met, then it is true freedom, or what is called libertarian freedom.
Right.
Now, when it comes, and I'm just restraining my remarks now to the question of salvation, because I'm reformed in my soteriology, that is, regarding salvation. But I do believe in libertarian freedom in vast areas of my life. I could do one or could have done otherwise in others.
Right.
So I have lots of choices I make that qualify there.
Right.
I do think I follow my desires, and I am limited in the range of choices by my nature, but I think I have limited freedom satisfying the CDO condition in many, many things. The question theologically is, as a fallen human being, do I have the kind of freedom in which I could have done otherwise? I don't see that in Scripture with regards to salvation and sin. That is what Pelagius argued, but I don't think that's in Scripture. I think, as I told an earlier caller, that we are enslaved by Satan, three different passages that make that statement very clear. We are enslaved to our own nature. We're slaves to sin. We are spiritually dead. We are disconnected from the life of God. And there are decisions that we can make, but apparently the decision we can't make is to consistently do good.
Right.
Sinning is an inevitability for fallen human beings, and we sin all the time. But God seems to think that we are held responsible for this, even though those choices don't categorically, taken as a category, satisfy the CDO condition. It might be in some cases I could say no to that sin, but I can't in every case because I don't want to say no to those sins. I want to sin.
Right.
And therefore, I do what I want to do, and I'm held responsible for that. So the Calvinist or the Reformed person is going to say, we do believe in freedom, and in many believe in libertarian freedom. But the question is, when it comes to the Scripture's characterization of fallen man, whether in fact it indicates that the CDO condition can be met such that a person can freely choose Christ or freely not choose in the sense of libertarian freedom. I do not think the Scripture says that.
Right.
And
I would agree with that. And that's kind of the rub that I've been receiving from, like, family members that are still in kind of the Arminian mindset, is most will tell me, you know, well, I believe that people choose, and I go back to, well, that's kind of what Pelagian theory went off on, and that's what Arminianism kind of went off to, and semi-Pelagianism, it's kind of like what Spurgeon says, where everybody is born into the kingdom thinking that they are Arminian until they begin to actually look at the doctrines of grace.
Yeah,
and
then right. I think that's true with a lot of folk. But I just want to offer a little corrective.
Sure.
When they say that we choose, I say to them, we do choose.
Right.
It's clear that we choose. The question is, what makes it possible for us to choose?
Right.
And the thing that makes it possible for us to choose is a work in it that God himself does, and I'm just going to use this language that I think I got from W.C.T. Shedd in Shedd's Dogmatics, where our wills are inclined against God, and therefore we choose what we want against him. God mercifully inclines our wills towards him, and so then we use those same wills that are inclined towards him now to choose in favor of him.
Right.
And I have to draw that conclusion because of the things that Jesus said. Listen here in John 6, I'm reading now, all that the Father gives me shall come to me. All that the Father gives me shall come to me. So somebody says, well, God gives everyone to Jesus. Well, no, he doesn't, because everybody
right.
doesn't come to him.
Right.
The active agent in this passage is the Father giving. And I will certainly not cast them out, for I have come down from heaven not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me. And this is the will of him who sent me, that of all he has given me, I lose nothing, but raise them up on the last day. For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who beholds the Son and believes in him may have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up in the last day. Now, it's interesting that last verse, 40, it's focusing more on the person's action. They behold the Son, they believe in him, they get eternal life, I'll raise him up in the last day. But how is that possible? It's because the Father has already given it to him and guaranteed they'd be raising it up on the last day. So
right.
in those few verses, 37 through 40 in John 6, you have both aspects being played in together. And we see that there in John chapter 10, we see a similar kind of thing. So what I think you ought to do when you talk to your friends on this issue is not to say, well, we don't choose, but that's our... I say, yes, we do choose, but what secures that choice? It's something that God does. And then you
right.
ask them to explain that verse that I just read to you, or
right.
in John 10, where Jesus says, why don't you hear my voice, which is the voice of the Holy Spirit drawing them into a relationship. He says, because you're not my sheep.
Right.
The Father gave me the sheep to me. He says, they hear my voice. I give eternal life. They follow me if they're really my sheep. And the Father's given them. I know them and they know me. No one shall snatch them out of my hand. My Father's given them to me. He's greater than all. No one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hand. So who's the most powerful one in that passage? The Father's hand.
Right.
You know, that's what determines. The Father gives and the Father secures. And so these are passages I think that folks on the other side of this equation have to make sense of in light of their own view. I think we can make sense of the choice verses the way Jonathan Edwards understands it, especially particularly with regard to salvation. But and there's plenty of room for libertarian free will in other areas. But see, these passages are pretty hard for me to deny that they are fairly univocal, and that is sovereign grace is their meaning. Hey, thank you for the call, Garrett. I certainly appreciate that. And I have more to say next hour, coming up our final hour, and lines are open here. The number 855-243-9975. The show is Stand to Reason. All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and glad to have you with me this hour, our final hour of this show. Remember, you can get the entire three-hour podcast easy, cheap, free, str.org. iTunes has it as well. You know, we are responding to an interest, I think, that people have to have a little bit more interaction with us as staff people. And so we are in the process of setting up some live online events. I think Google Hangout on Air is the device or the program or whatever it is that is available to us to do that. So let me let you know about a live online event that Brett Kunkel is going to be participating in Thursday, April 24th. It'll be 7 p.m. Pacific time. All right. And Brett's going to discuss how to train your kids to defend their faith. And it'll be on Google Hangout on Air. You'll be able to send your questions in before and during the event. Brett will answer them live. And keep an eye out on Stand to Reason's Google Plus page as well as str.org because we'll be doing more of these events. More information will be coming soon. But note this one, our kickoff event, April 24th, 7 p.m. Pacific time, live Google Hangout on Air with Brett Kunkel. So I hope you enjoy that. Take advantage of it. Last week, a week ago tonight, I was at Washburn University. You know, and I have to tell you, it might be good just to admit this, I always get a little nervous. I might have even said this before, a little nervous when I'm on a secular university. Our mission is to train Christians to defend their faith and to think better about their faith and et cetera, et cetera. So we train Christians, the first part of our mission. This is why we spend most of our time with Christians. But I don't want to eschew the opportunities that I might have to engage non-Christians. For one, that's necessary. For two, it keeps me hopping. And I do that on a private basis, but publicly it's helpful too because others in the audience can then see how some of the things that I talk about on the air and in the books and in our Solid Ground newsletter, etc., how that plays out in actual conversation with people. And so it's good to be able to do that and to provide that opportunity for people, but it is it's still, I just want to admit, a little discomforting. If I go into a university environment and I know there's going to be an ideologically hostile audience. Now, they are rarely hostile in an extreme way that makes everybody kind of, or me, really uncomfortable, but I have to deal with things on my feet. I give a talk in some sense about some topic, and then we have Q&A afterwards. And then that gives them a chance to weigh in and, you know, challenge, test my mettle or my ideas. It's kind of a peer review, and it's good. And I know a lot of the believers that happen to be there, and it's usually sponsored by a church or by a consortium of churches or possibly a campus group or groups. So they're hanging out, and they want to see, well, how is he going to handle that? Because I've been challenged by that before, and I haven't known what to say. And so I can kind of play out these things. So even in those environments, it's a training situation or circumstance for the Christians. So it's still, we train Christians. Now, some organizations like Ravi Zacharias's organization are more decidedly evangelistic. They are going out not to train Christians as much as to testify to the truth of Christianity and answer the challenges to demonstrate that Christianity can compete in the marketplace of ideas. So here I am, Washburn University, and I'm feeling a little bit uncomfortable. What's going to happen here? 5 weeks ago now, end of January, was it? I was at the University of Toronto, and there we had a much more aggressive crowd. Things worked out fine, but it was aggressive. And I had a number of things to deal with, and I told you about that. As it turns out, at Washburn, a very secular school, about 800 feet people showed up, and I would say two-thirds of them seemed like they were from the community, and if from the community, probably there because of the churches or the church's publicity or whatever, and so therefore followers of Christ. I asked for a show of hands. How many students are actually here? The old fogies got here early and got all the front seats. The students were kind of more in the back. And I suspect that some of those students were Christians. But, okay, fine. I feel a little bit more encouraged, but I'm directing my comments here, now talking about the problem of evil. I'm directing my comments to the non-Christians in the audience. So I'm addressing them as if everybody there was not a follower of Christ. And I have a very particular way of dealing with the problem of evil. I want to tell you in just a moment about a university professor who came to the mic and challenged me on some things, but I want to give you a little feedback on how my talk developed so that you can understand the reason he asked the questions that he did. The way I do my talk on the problem of evil is I point out that the problem of evil is a problem for everyone, not just for Christians, because it's the non-Christian who's raising the problem to begin with. And so I presume they think the problem is real. That is, there's real evil in the world. And it, you may not follow all of this right now, and that's all right. This isn't the talk. You can get this talk, by the way, through Stand to Reason, and it's called Evil, Suffering, and the Goodness of God. I also wrote an article many years ago that that contains many of these elements called Sophie's Dilemma, a playoff of the movie Sophie's Choice, which is my opening illustration. But I start out by saying it's everybody's problem, not just the theist problem. So if you want to be an atheist because of the problem of evil, don't think that you have sidestepped the problem. All you've done is eliminate one way of solving it. That is, any solution that's related to theism, you can't use that because you've rejected that. Now you still have to solve the problem of evil, explain why evil is in the world, make sense of good, given a materialistic view of reality. And if there is a problem of evil, it strikes me that relativism is false, because there can only be a problem of evil if there is objective evil in the world, and if good and bad are just make-me-ups grounded in each individual, then there's no evil out there to complain about. There are just different points of view that people have about what's good and bad. So if there's a real problem of evil, relativism is false. There's got to be some scoring system, some transcendent scoring system for us to define, identify what is good and bad. So relativism must be false because relativism denies the scoring system. But this casts question now on atheism, because if there is transcendent evil, then there has to be a transcendent scoring system. And where did the scoring system come from? The right and a moral law comes from a moral lawmaker. That is, it seems that laws that create obligations can only come from a person, just like books need writers, moral laws, moral law makers. And therefore, the presence of evil in the world turns out to be kind of an argument, not only against relativism, but against atheism as well. In fact, that is the nature of the moral argument for God. It looks at the reality of morality in the world and argues from that to God as the best explanation. Now, in May, I have a whole article dealing with that argument and showing why the evolutionary answer cannot account for the morality that is necessary for atheists to produce to sidestep the moral argument for God's existence. And so you can look forward to that in May. And if you don't receive it, go to str.org and sign up for it. It's free. We'll mail it to you. We'll email it to you. You'll get it both directions. You can send it on to other people. But I think this is a real good argument dealing with the challenge. Why not just be good for goodness sake? You don't need God to be good. All right. And or belief in God to be good. In any event, at this point in the talk, I then point out that moral freedom resolves the apparent contradiction between theism and evil in the world. And then I give four things that God is actually doing in the world to deal with the problem of evil. And one of the things he does to mitigate the impact of evil that is in the world is that he established certain institutions that will help keep things in check for a while, the institutions of government and of family and of church. And if those institutions are operating the way God intended, there's less evil. And if we abandon the directives for those things, there's more evil. This is quantifiable. But I anticipated an objection, and all of this is leading up to the professor's comment. I anticipated an objection, and the objection is, well, look, religion has actually caused more evil in the world than anything else. And I said, that is factually false. And if you read the tactics book, you know that this is a just the facts, ma'am, tactic. On the merits, on the facts alone, this is just not true. The 20th century, I explained to the audience that night on this point, was the bloodiest century in the history of the world, and 100 million people plus, that's a conservative estimate, died at the hands of three men, all sporting secular ideologies. Stalin, Lenin, and Mao Zedong. Materialists all, atheists all, communists all. And when I said that there were three men that were responsible for 100 million deaths, I also said, and Hitler wasn't one of them. All right? Now, I did say I am not, you know, Hitler's a bad guy, but he's not as bad as these guys. And I did say that this doesn't mean that atheists all do this kind of thing, but I did say that atheism as a worldview opens the door for it because there is so, I don't see any moral principle inherent to atheism itself that inveighs against the kinds of things that these men did. If there is no God, there is no one to answer to. Might makes right. We can do whatever we want as long as we're strong enough to get away with it. If you want to invoke natural selection, boy, it works fine here. And Lenin and Stalin and Mao, you know, work that strategy to a T. And therefore, there were 100 million plus that were dead. Now, when a time came for Q&A, a gentleman got up, identified himself as a professor from the university. And he had a number of objections. And I just want to tell you what they were, because when he said he was the professor, I thought, well, I'm going to get something substantial here. When he said he is a professor of philosophy, I thought, well, look, I'm going to maybe meet my match. I better be sharp here. What was the first complaint that he raised, or the first principled objection to the points that I had made? Here was the first one. I'm offended. I'm offended that you said one of them wasn't Hitler. Hitler killed 6 million Jews. I said, yeah, and he killed 6 million Gentiles too. He's no small player on the world scene. He's a bad guy. But compared to Hitler, the other ones were a lot worse. That was my point. And I just want you to notice something. I did not say this to the professor in that venue, because there are a whole lot of rank-and-file folk that would not have understood the spirit of my response to him. I did say, look, I didn't say he was small potatoes. I just said compared to the others, if you think Hitler's bad, these guys are really bad. And the really bad guys weren't religious. They were secularists. They were atheists. And so they just count the bodies. And I made the point that not all atheists do this. And that was his second complaint. You know, just because they're atheists doesn't mean they're going to do this. Hitler was excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church, he said. Now, I think the implication there is, he's excommunicated. So he's Roman Catholic. So he's a religious person, and therefore this is religious evil. No, it's not. It's not religious evil. He didn't do this in the name of any religion or because of any religious views. He did it because he wanted power. He used religion to his advantage, and I think the fact that he was excommunicated, if he was, from the Roman Catholic Church, makes it clear that the Christians didn't own him. He wasn't one of them, is the point. Now, the thing that I could have said to the professor that I chose not to because the audience would have understood it is shame on you. Professor, you're a professor of philosophy. that your feelings are hurt by something I said has no bearing on the legitimacy of the argument I just offered. Was a fact I offer wrong? Is my argument invalid? Is my argument unsound? Do I equivocate on some of the words? Tell me what I missed here. But don't tell me your feelings are hurt. I mean, it was embarrassing, actually, for me. And do you notice I use an a fortiori argument, Professor, from the lesser to the greater? I didn't say that Hitler's crimes were minimized. I say as bad as they were, these guys were worse. And if you think bad of Hitler, you should think worse of these guys. That's the line of argument. He should have understood that. And anyway, were the secularists worse than the so-called religious person? Yes, lots worse. That was my point. And apparently he didn't get that. Now, he did raise a legitimate point, because my argument was against the what's called the deductive problem of evil. That is, if there is, you say God is good and he's powerful. If he's good, he'd want to get rid of evil. If he's powerful, he'd be able to get rid of evil. But there still is evil. So he's either not good or not powerful or probably doesn't exist. So what there appears to be, in the way the argument is characterized, there appears to be a contradiction between the existence of evil in the world and the existence of God. Now, of course, you noticed, if you were listening, that I was trying to point out, if there is evil in the world that's transcendent, that is adequate to ground your objection, well, then there's got to be a God to make sense of that condition, to author, if you will, in some fashion, the set of rules that people violate when they do evil in the world. I mean, that was another part of the discussion. But having what I hopefully dispatched of the deductive problem, there is another problem called the inductive problem. And this is what he raised. And this was a legitimate point. He said, well, there is a lot of pointless evil in the world. And it just doesn't seem to be the case that it's probably not the case that God exists, since there's so much pointless evil in the world. Just the existence of evil doesn't qualify it. But when you have so much pointless evil, there doesn't seem to be a morally sufficient reason for the amount of evil we see, and therefore God probably does not exist. And he said, so you didn't address that particular point. Well, which he's right. I was dealing with a different version, but now I have a question of the professor. Because remember, his argument goes, if there is pointless evil in the world, then there is no God, and there is pointless evil in the world, therefore there is no God. Okay, I get it. Now I got a question for you, Professor. How do you know that all the suffering in the world, all the evil that you see, is pointless? Now that is a fair question for me to ask, and actually that's the weakness of his view. Because it presumes that we have insight into all of the particulars that we probably don't have. And I can tell you, for one, I looked at some really ugly stuff that happened to me when quite a number of years ago now, over 30 years ago, and there were really rough things in my own life, and it seemed like pointless suffering. And now I look back and I see there was a point to all of it, and something that God used for some morally justifiable reason in my own life. I'm not going to get into the details, but you can see that too. So there are times when on the one hand it looks pointless, but we then get insight and we realize it wasn't pointless. There was a morally justifiable reason. And if that's true with some things we can see, why are we so certain that it's not true of things we can't see, that we can't see behind? We just see the suffering and we say there's no point to that. We would have to be nearly omniscient to know that. And so I asked the question, how do you know it's pointless? Because he's got to be able to demonstrate that or say that with some level of confidence and certainty in order for his argument to go through. And here's what he said to me. He said, how do you know it isn't pointless? Now, those of you who are familiar with tactics know what he just did. It was a textbook case of the professor's ploy, where the professor makes a claim, and instead of defending the claim himself, the claim that is central to his argument, he rather says, he tells the theist to disprove his claim, and if we can't disprove his claim, then he thinks the claim stands. But that's not the way it works. The burden of proof is on the person who makes the claim. If he offers an argument, it's his job to justify the relevant premises. And if he can't justify the relevant premises, then his argument is weakened or it doesn't go through. And this is the way I responded in textbook fashion, since I wrote the textbook on this one. The tactics, and this is tactic question number two. How'd you come to that conclusion? And he then reversed the burden of proof. Disprove me. Don't make me prove my own view. You disprove me. And I said, look, Professor, it is not my job to disprove your point. You are advancing the point as a part of your argument. You bear the burden of proof to defend your point. It is not my job to defeat it. And at that, I think he just abandoned the discussion. What I want you to see, though, friends, it worked out okay. And as I talked to people afterwards, there are actually quite a number of the rank-and-file folk, old fogies, and even students of his that didn't have a lot of philosophical training, but they could see he was barking up the wrong tree. It was a kind of a lame response. It was one of those occasions where people who are really smart, and I'm sure he was very smart, he had a PhD in philosophy, but he ended up making really substandard objections. Of course, the inductive problem isn't a substandard objection, but when I challenged him on one of his points, he bailed out. On one of his premises, he just bailed out. And it wasn't a noble way of trying to advance his own argument. This happens all the time. People who are really smart end up making foolish mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. And in this particular case, the whole audience could see it, even though he couldn't see it himself. So don't be intimidated by the smart guys. Sometimes they make big mistakes. Sometimes not, but oftentimes they do. So I have more I could say about the inductive problem. What I'd like to do is I'd like to go to break right now and then come back to our calls. We've got Carl and La Mesa holding on. We'll get to his question in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Back with you here at Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, your host, giving you a piece of my mind today. And with you every Tuesday, just about, live from make that 4 to 7. That's Los Angeles time. So if you want to call in the show, on our live line, you can do that, 855-243-9975. And call during those times. We'll put you on board. I noticed today we got a ton of people on right out of the gate. That was great. Kept us going for a while. And then it slacks off a little towards the end. So if you can't get in the first hour of our live broadcast, think about calling in on the last hour. It might be easier for you to do that. If you're outside the U.S., you can dial direct 562. Make that 1-562. That's the international number for the United States of America. 1-562-424-8229. All right, let's. Carl, you are one patient guy.
Yes, well, it's you're worth waiting for, Greg.
Wow, that was really sweet. That was great. I wasn't digging for that, but I appreciate it. Thanks.
Sure. I had a question here. I heard a lecture by you a while back, something about the five fingers of the hand is five proofs for the or five reasons to believe the Bible, something like that. Don't recall the exact title.
Yeah, I actually, there's six reasons that I think that the Bible is not a book by men about God, but rather a book by God to man in some way, because they have supernatural marks on them. So they indicate it's more than just a human document. There's actually six of them.
Okay.
And so you have five fingers and you make a fist, and that's the sixth one.
Okay. Anyway, one of the fingers was a fulfilled prophecy.
Right.
And in looking into that, it seems like it's kind of a can of snakes. There are some claims that have been made that I think are, sometimes... Well, less than credible.
Mm-hmm.
There even seems to be a kind of a meta problem where the it seems the Bible prophecy buffs paint them or give themselves a no lose script. You know, if they can possibly find some historical event to tie to a Bible prophecy, then that's evidence that the Bible is from God or whatever. But if there's no historical event tied to a prophecy, then it just hasn't been fulfilled yet.
Well, I mean, that may sound like cheating, but that is the nature of prophecy. I mean, and if what one can say, and I'm not saying that all of their specific claims are legitimate claims, but if there are a series of prophecies given, and then we see what seem to be clear examples of these prophecies being fulfilled, and they're detailed enough to be not like Edgar Cayce and some of these people in the past, Gene Dixon or whoever it was, they used to give these really general prophecies. If there are detailed enough to be significant, and then it seems that we have good reason to believe they predate the events, then I think it's fair to say these were fulfilled, and there's some things that have not yet been fulfilled because they are still in the future. I don't think that is illicit.
Okay.
In terms of what else, how else can you proceed? That's the nature of prophecy.
Okay. Anyway, my original question was really: can you recommend a good, intellectually credible book for me to study on the subject? That's my main request there.
Well, let me think. Let me think. It seems to me, I don't have one right off the top of my head. No, sometimes there are prophecy books that relate to an understanding of the second coming. Like if you're pre-trib, pre-millennial understanding, then you could see how people will try to match up present day events with their understanding of the Old Testament prophecies. I personally don't think those are that helpful, and that isn't the kind that I would recommend.
No, that's not kind of what I'm looking for. I'm looking more for where Isaiah prophesied a certain thing, and in history, sure enough, it happened. Something like that,
Well, there's a book that I just kind of vaguely in my mind here. It has the word prophecy in it, and I'm Woodward. The guy I'm thinking of was an Old Testament professor over at Trinity Seminary, maybe Amy's working on this right now. But I'm sorry, Amy, or any of you, when I come up with these really piecemeal type titles, I can't remember the details. I can't remember. Who's the other, the Old Testament prophet, Trinity? I don't know. Maybe I'll be able to, somebody will bring it to me in just a few minutes. But you don't, introduction, I think, to Old Testament history or something like that would cover this topic. Here's my concern with some prophecies. Some prophecies seem to be that are identified as fulfilled prophecies in the life of Jesus seem to be too vague to be persuasive to critics when you cite them.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but there are other ones that aren't. So I'm not going to be citing those prophecies that seem vague.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be citing those ones that seem to be really precise and not vague. Now, I'll give you some examples, the way I would go about it. Isaiah 53,
mm-hmm.
I think, is a powerful prophecy that is fulfilled in the person of Christ. The controversy there is that in some places in Isaiah, the servant is Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's clear. But there are other places, especially the suffering servant passages, where it can't be Israel, because it's clear that Isaiah is saying that this particular servant is suffering for Israel's sins.
Mm-hmm.
Our griefs he himself bore, you know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
He was pierced through for our iniquities. And So that's the Isaiah 53 passage. I think a very reasonable case can be made for that applying to Jesus. And we know that this prophecy predated Christ because of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay.
There might have been people in the past who said otherwise, but not now, because the Dead Sea Scrolls produced copies of Isaiah that included this portion that we know came before Christ.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I saw an ancient document. I was there when it was uncovered of the Septuagint that was prior to the time of Christ from this section of Isaiah. So we know these prophecies predated Christ. I think another prophecy is Psalm 22. And Psalm 22 seems to be a description of a crucifixion. And there are a number of details in Psalm 22 that seemed to match up very precisely with details at the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth. And so you have a physical description of this person being tormented in a way that seems to be a description of a crucifixion. They pierce my hands and my feet. They can count all my bones. They laugh. They mock. They divide my clothes in front of me. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Far from the words of my groaning are my deliverance. I mean, these are all part of Psalm 22.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, I think to a fair-minded person, this seems to match a Roman crucifixion hundreds of years before crucifixion was ever practiced. And there's a prophecy. I think the prophecy of Daniel 9, which is called the 70 weeks prophecy, is a very powerful prophecy because it identifies a time once the clock starts ticking with a decree, which turns out to be the decree of Artaxerxes in 444 BC, as I recall. Once that clock starts ticking, there are a very specific number of days that pass, 173,000, is that right? Days that will pass. No, that could be right. Whatever, you can do the calculations, and I don't have my notes in front of me, so I shouldn't guess at the numbers. But there is a specific number of days until the Messiah is cut off. It turns out when you do the math, according to the way that the Jews calculated the calendar from that day to the number of days count off, you come to Passion Week, 33 AD, the month of Nisan. So it's like this counting lands on Passion Week, which is the precise week that Jesus of Nazareth was executed. And Jesus even says something on Palm Sunday, which is coming up next weekend, that seems to almost hint at the fulfillment of this prophecy. And he says there in the triumphal entry, he weeps over Jerusalem and he says, if you had noticed, if you had only known this day of your visitation. Now, it's not a knockdown, drag-out argument, but it could be that this was culmination of the days. And 5 days later, he was cut off, which is Old Testament lingo for being killed. And then there's a missing week that hasn't been fulfilled yet, but those numbers match up. And a lot of work has been done with it. It's credible work. And I think this is compelling. So these are the kinds of prophecies that I would make reference to that have, I think, some legitimacy for having been fulfilled in the life of Christ. There's a lot more in the book of Daniel, a lot more prophecies. He prophesies the next four kingdoms from Babylon to the Medo-Persian Empire to the Greek Empire to the Romans. And he does it at different ways with different imagery, but it fits perfectly. And then he gives lots of details of political intrigue that are all there. In fact, there's so much detail, people think, well, this must have been written afterwards because it can't possibly be prophecy. So because of anti-supernatural bias, they're going to dismiss it. Those are the kinds of references that I would suggest. And when we go to break in just a bit, I'm going to see if I can find the title of that book. It bugs me because I can see it kind of in my mind's eye sitting on my bookshelf, but I can't recall the author's name. But he is formerly of Trinity University, Evangelical Divinity School. So Josh McDowell has a lot of this, too, in Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Okay. And that might be a book that you want to go to. In fact, that was the first book that I ever saw that had all of those prophecies. Some of them, he's got listed, are going to seem a little bit vague and a little reach in terms of their fulfillment, but there's going to be plenty enough of other ones that it's going to be that I think you can make a case.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
All right, good talking to you, Carl. I appreciate the call. And let's see, where am I? Right here, is that line? Okay, did it, got it right. And I'm going to go to break here, and I'll be back for our final segment on Stand to Reason. Thanks.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com. and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason. Let's go to Phil in Salina, Ohio. Hello, Phil. Glad you called.
Hey, Greg. Thank you for taking my call.
You've had the shortest wait of anyone all month.
I heard you say a couple weeks ago that sometimes you're thin on calls at the end of the show, so I decided to give it a shot here.
You nailed it, buddy. I actually said that just a minute ago too. It must be bouncing off the atmospheres or something. So what's on your mind today, Phil?
Well, yeah, no, I thank you for all you do. I've benefited a ton from your work and my question, I hope I don't catch you on a bad day. I think sometimes, you know, asking questions about Calvinism and Arminianism can be tiresome, and every once in a while I hear somebody ask a question and I can sense a little, maybe just weariness in your voice. So I don't want to cause that.
No, you're not causing that. And if it's weariness in my voice, it's either that I'm just generally weary or I'm just kind of fed up with it's something else, like what I talked about with Mozilla. I'd had weariness in my voice because of all of that that's going on right now with the all of this the bullying that's going on the homosexuality issue. But ironically, they teach classes against bullying regarding homosexuals, but those are the biggest bullies on the planet right now. Anyway,
right.
Different issue. So, no, I'm not at all tired of talking about this topic.
Well, good.
I
consider myself an Arminian, but I also am, man, I really value, guys on the other side, mm-hmm. yourself and, mm-hmm. you know, John MacArthur and, mm-hmm. and others. So anyway, I don't want to be overly divisive, but this is a question I do have. So
sure.
The way I want to ask it, I guess, is if monergism is true, and maybe I'm assuming too much, but I believe that that's your view. If,
yes.
if monergism uh-huh. is true,
it's God's taking the initiative to act, and it's the one way acting, and what he does is fully adequate to the task, right? It isn't a little bit of us and a little bit of him, correct?
Right. If monergism is true and God is solely responsible for the choice of who is saved, and it has nothing to do with anything he sees in us,
mm-hmm.
And 1 Timothy 2:4, there will be other similar verses. 1 Timothy 2:4 says that God wants all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So if God is solely responsible and he wants all men to be saved, why are all men not saved?
Not saved. There are two passages. You cited the first one, and the second one is in 2 Peter that makes this statement. And there, I have two different answers. You didn't mention the second one, but I have a different answer for each verse.
Okay.
In the end, I used to use the same answer for each verse, which I think is going to be adequate. And it's an answer that John Piper develops in an appendix in either Desiring God or the other book that's kind of like Desiring God, but with a similar title. It's a little different. I can't remember. There's Desiring God and Pursuit of God or something like that. But in an appendix, he asks the question, does God have two wills? Does God have two wills? His answer is yes. And it's the same answer that I give. Because if there isn't two senses of the will of God, at least two senses, then you cannot avoid a contradiction in the Bible. And so there are some places where it says that God's will cannot be opposed, and there it's other places where it says clearly, it identifies an aspect of God's will that can clearly be opposed. So 1 Thessalonians 4 says that here is the will of God, even your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality. Well, it's pretty clear that everybody doesn't do that.
Right.
So there is a will, one sense of God's will that can be opposed. That is that God desires to take place, but men don't obey it. Well, let's just call it his moral will, for lack of a better word, but at least we understand what we're talking about. Then other places says who resists his will, or God does according to his will on the earth and in heaven. And so here's a sense where we see a description of the sovereign power of God to accomplish when he decides he wants something, and then he sets his And when he uses his power to accomplish it, well, he gets what he wants. So let's just call that sovereign will for the sake of discussion. If we don't make that distinction, then we have a contradiction. So there must be a sense in which that's the case. So if I can defend from other verses that monergism is defensible, and I cited passages from John 10 and John 6 with an earlier caller, then it does raise the question, well, in what sense then is it God's will for all to be saved? And I could easily say, well, it must not be a sovereign will because he does not accomplish the salvation of everybody. Therefore, it must be his moral will, just like he wants all people to be spirit-filled and he wants people to, you know, rejoice always. This is the will of God. Pray unceasingly and be sexually pure. So so I think that that is a legitimate answer. It may not be the right answer, but what it does, I mean, there may be other alternatives or something, but when this objection is raised, as you've done, it appears that there's a contradiction between the monergistic view and the desire that God wants all to be saved. All I have to do is raise a credible possibility to avoid the contradiction. I don't have to be absolutely certain it's right, since the complaint is this can't be the so because of the contradiction. If I can raise a credible alternative, then I've parlayed in a sense the defeater, and in Desiring God or whatever that other book is, then Piper does the same thing in a much more thoroughgoing way, and I think that's a legitimate way to deal with it. That, for my purposes, satisfies the concern out of the 1 Timothy chapter 2 passage.
Can I ask a sure. follow-up to that?
Then? Yeah, and then I'll go to Peter.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, I've heard your decision-making. That was super influential for me. I came out of kind of I wasn't a real charismatic background or anything, but, you know, people talk that way, God
sure.
told me. And so I'm familiar with your distinction between God's sovereign will and moral will from that, and that makes a ton of sense to me. The problem I have in this verse, though, is that, you know, if God made this, you know, monergistic choice before the creation of the world, it seems like there would be nobody to oppose his decision. So I can understand, you know, it's God's will, his moral will, that everybody be sexually moral or behave in a sexually pure way, and that people resist that because there's somebody in existence to resist it. But if God made that decision before the creation of the world monergistically about who would be saved, there would have been nobody to resist it. So what would have prevented God from, you know, again, if he's the only one responsible making that choice according
maybe
to
I
his
didn't
moral
make,
will.
Yeah, maybe I didn't make a point clear. I think that God is expressing his moral will, not his sovereign will, in that passage. He is not expressing the will that no one could resist. He is expressing the will that this is the right thing to do, but people will resist it just like they do the sexual purity thing. So did I clarify that adequately for you, or did I miss your question?
I mean, No, I mean, I think I understand what you're saying.
Part of what I have to do, God is expressing a will in the 1 Timothy passage similar to the 1 Thessalonians 4 passage. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of will he's describing there. When he describes a sovereign will of election, let me back up and put it this way. In John 6, when it talks about what God the Father wills, it's that none that he gives to the Son will be saved, will be lost, rather, but he will raise them up in the last day. That is an expression of sovereign will there. Those that come to Jesus, God is sovereignly, by his strength, securing them. And we see a hint of that also in John 10, where he says, no one will snatch them out of the Father's hand because no one is greater than the Father. So it is the power of the Father to secure those whom he has given to the Son. That's the language in John 10. Now, I think that there are kind of untidy aspects to this and loose ends, and I wish it was just all so much more cleaner. what I have to do for
myself. On both sides. On both sides.
Yeah,
in
general. Yeah. And I wish what I'm trying to do is take the rest on what more are the unequivocal statements, like I mentioned, the John 6 and the John 10. And I think I don't see how I can read these in another way than kind of a sovereign grace way. Now, the Timothy passage, I can read it in a way that's consistent with sovereign grace. Maybe that's not the tidiest reading at face value, but if I don't take that reading, then I'm stuck with a contradiction. And then I don't know how I can take the John passages that I've just said in a way that's consistent with an Arminian viewpoint. So, you know, I'm going
to maybe I'll call and offer a solution to that another time. I'll stick to the First Timothy.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for doing that. I have read these things. John 10, why don't you hear my voice? Because my Father has not given you to me. That's why you don't hear my voice. You know, and I don't know. It's pretty straightforward.
But doesn't that sound like that grace is resistible, that God is calling and extending and offering, and, you know, he wants all men to be saved, and that some are rejecting that? That sounds like resistible grace.
No, the grace that Calvinists have in mind when they talk about irresistible grace is not in play there. Elective grace is not resistible, but there is no elective grace in that situation. This is why they are resisting Jesus, clearly, but they are not resisting elective grace, because it's elective grace that is the voice of Jesus, the Holy Spirit that he's referring to. You don't hear my voice because there's no elective grace that's being exercised there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the question, though, that would, it's just like, if he wants all men to be saved, why didn't he extend elective grace to them?
Well, that's a question he's going to have to answer to me, you know, but he didn't. And I can't. Some people have offered characterizations or answers to that. I don't think I'm equipped to do so. Let me just say something about the First Peter passage.
Second Peter 3.
Peter 3. Yeah. I used to have the same view that I have about the First Timothy passage to the first Second Peter one, and I had heard Calvinist types that said, well, this, he's referring to all the elect being saved, you know, and you probably heard that too. God wants all the elect to be saved, and you know, how are they sticking that in there? I thought, well, that was a little self-serving, until I read the passage very carefully. And in the passage, let me just see here. Did you say verse 9 of chapter 3?
Yeah, it's verse 9.
Okay, the Lord is not slow about his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing for any, well, there's no any what? It just says any to perish, but for all what? It doesn't say. Now, what we think that we should put in there is all human beings, or any human beings, and this is what people automatically do. But if you put that into the text, you have a grammatical problem, and you also have a logical problem, because what John is saying, I mean Peter is saying here, is that God isn't slow, but he's waiting. And what is he waiting for? He hasn't come yet, because he is waiting for something to happen. And the thing that he's waiting for to happen on one reading is all for all people to come, and for no person to perish. But of course, you and I both know that's not going to happen. And if he's waiting for that, he's going to be waiting forever. And then I look at the way it's the grammar. The Lord is not slow about his promises, some count slowness, but is patient toward you. Now, there's the antecedent. Patient towards you, not wishing for any of you to perish. Now, I'm putting that in there because the antecedent is you, but for all of you to come to repentance. You work backwards on that preposition, starting from the beginning of the chapter, of chapter 1, and the you that is being spoken of in every single case are the Christians. And I have been completely convinced by this now, going through from verse 1, looking at who is being addressed, who is the you in every single case where he's using first person, or second person plural, It is always the believers. And it is the believers then in verse 9 of chapter 3 who is the you, the people he's been talking to the whole time that have the faith that he does. And so what he is saying here is the patience of God is waiting for the entire company of the elect to come in so that none of the elect perish. There are others that are going to believe that are part of God's elect. And by the way, you can characterize the elect in any way you want. But it is clear that the ones that he does not want to perish are the ones that are, in an Arminian sense or Calvinist sense, elect. But he doesn't want any of those elect to perish. I think that that is a legitimate way of looking at now once I've done the looking at those pronouns throughout the text.
Yeah, I'm not sure what translation you have. I've got the NIV 1984 in front of me. It says he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance.
I know.
So maybe I'm hampered by my translation. Maybe that's something that
I think that's there. The case. The NIV puts words in there that are interpretive.
What is the last part of the? What I don't know what translation you're using.
New American
but what is
Standard.
The last phrase there? But everyone to come to repentance.
But
or what
all.
Did you say? That all come to repentance.
Not everyone. Okay, so the NIV has a habit of doing this kind of thing. So what you want to do, and I trust in terms of more exact literalness, that is where the translators use the exact meaning of the word rather than expanding the meaning to include what they think it means, the New American Standard is better. The NIV expands. So if you read the word flesh, sarx, in the Greek and the New Testament, it'll be translated flesh every single time it appears. But flesh could mean fallen humanity, or it could mean flesh and blood, like just ordinary human being. And the NIV decides for you. I don't think they always get it right. In my view, they should just translate it flesh. And I would not be surprised if in this instance they've done the same thing. If you want to do a little, you know, interlinear, a little look, or look in your concordance and see what words, but I think that the New American Standard is more precise in this regard. Hey, Phil, great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for your response. I'm going to get the podcast and listen to it again.
Okay, dynamite.
And weigh things a little bit more.
Yes, okay, will do. Thank you. I appreciate that call. And that's it for our show today. Boy, what an energetic show. I am a little bit hoarse now. After all this great conversation with you guys and the strong words I had to say about some of the current events. But thank you for staying with me, and look forward to next time. In the meantime, give them heaven, okay, friends? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.